What is up, everybody? Welcome to the Otaku Spirit Anime Cast. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined here, as always, with Chris.
Yep.
Today's episode is our summer 2022 anime season first impressions. It's time to go through all the shows of the season currently, let you guys know what is currently kind of panning out to be something good. Of course, this is going to be a two-parter. I thought about doing three. Two-parter. I think the only reason I don't want to do three is because then we're going to get in like the mid-season point, so it's just a bit too much. But yeah, just way too much stuff to do two or one, so definitely have to do two. So, but yeah, this episode we will go through Vermil and Gold, Yore Deco, Ruby, Ice Queendom, Licorice Coil, My Stepmom's Daughter Is My Ex, Chimimo, Tokyo Mew Mew New, Made in Abyss Second Season, Joshin Chan, Dropkick X, Teppin, Black Summoner, Shine Post, Harem in a Labyrinth of Another World, When Will Ayumu Make His Move, Smile of the Arch Notoria, The Animation, Uncle from Another World, Engage Kiss, and we'll wrap things up with Utawaramono Futari no Hokuro, or The Mask of Truth. So, good stuff. Lots of really great titles. I think this season, it's one of those ones where, like, every season lately, I've been going, like, this is going to be an amazing season, and everybody's kind of going, yeah, you said that last season. Yeah, you said that last season. I'm like, no, this is legit this season. Like, the problem with, like, the previous seasons, you have, like, that first episode or so syndrome where everything's, like, really cool, and you obviously know that it can always go downhill from there. Anything can go downhill from any point, but it was one of those, this season, it's like, there's just way too much stuff, and I want to cover it all. Like, last season, I thought I was going to cover a lot of stuff, and I didn't cover much stuff. This season, it's like, yeah, I'm like, one day I have two shows I want to cover. No, two days that I have two shows I want to cover. It's absolutely insane, so. And of course, all of the returning stuff is the big shock, too, for a lot of people. So, yeah, without further ado, again, we're at otakuspirit.com. That's where you can go for all of our stuff. We have social media links there, ways you can help support us. We definitely appreciate everybody that supports the channel. It means a great deal to us. But, yeah, let's start. Vermil and Gold. Are you excited?
Yeah, I'm desperately trying to keep up. But, yeah, we'll do what we can.
I know. Everybody's like wondering, where's Chris for live streams? And I've cut down to once per week. I do an anime stream where we talk about anime and stuff like that. But like just gaming streams, not happening right now. There's too much stuff that we're trying to cover. So this is all for Chris's sake to be able to jump on here and give his impressions on everything. Did you get everything?
I hope I do okay. No.
Did you watch everything?
No.
With how much you're hiding yourself up in your room, you couldn't watch everything?
I am desperately trying to keep up with all the shows.
And he's been reading other stuff, too.
No, that's the fault. At work.
That's the fault. He's listening to audio books. But anyways, yes, let's start off with Vermil and Gold. This one is Kinso no Vermil. Gakekibuchi. I should stop reading the Japanese titles. Wa Saikyo no Yakusai. I think everybody enjoys me doing that, though. To Maho Sekai wo Suki Susumi. Susumu. This one's streaming on High Dive, running for 12 episodes. This one's bound by Studio Staple Entertainment. Sources of manga. Genres are ecchi fantasy. Director is Takashi Naoya, who did 3D Kanojo, Childhood Friend Won't Lose. Series composition by Tatsuya Takahashi, who did Slime for 300 Years, Killed Slime for 300 Years, Idolmaster, Cinderella Girl, Ioli Pride, and Domestic Girlfriend. So, good stuff there. But yeah, this kind of takes place at a magic academy. You have all these people that are there to train in magic. And we follow one such Alto Goldfield. And this guy is really good at magic. Everybody praises how good he is. His grades are really fantastic. But there's one problem. He hasn't summoned a familiar yet. He's really terrible at it. And the teachers basically tell him, look, if you don't summon a familiar, you're going to get held back a grade. Because apparently the second years, a lot of their curriculum is around their familiar. So he kind of needs one. It's not a case of like, yeah, we'll let this slide. It's like, no, you can't train in your second year without a familiar. So he's very desperate. He's got his childhood friend Lilia is like desperate for him to pass. But, you know, he has to do it on his own. And he's walking around inside of a library, and eventually a book falls on his head, and he looks at it. It's really old, dusty, but he's like, hey, I wonder if this could possibly be a summoning book. Well, let me look at it. And he looks at it at home, and he's like, oh, yeah, there's a summoning circle in here, and he draws it. And then suddenly this big, like, very well endowed, very sexy lady just pops up out of nowhere, and she's got horns, and she's got a tail. Oh, yeah, this is a demon, and he just summoned a demon. And he quickly makes a pact with her. She accepts it, and what we find out is that she's actually been sealed away in this tome for a very long time. She did some nasty things in the past. They sealed her in this book. And now he's basically freed her and made a pact with him. And what we find out over time is that, oh, the reason why he's been so terrible at summoning and he hasn't been able to get a familiar yet is because he has so much mana. Any familiar would be like, you know, they would instantly blow up if they accepted a contract with him. So no familiars would want to make a pact with him because he has too much mana. But she's the opposite in the idea that she's a demon, whereas demons typically will take the life of the person that summons them because they take so much mana. She's able to basically feed off of how much great amount of mana he has. So they make like a nice little pack there. So yeah, he has to take her to school. Everybody believes that she's just some hot lady that he brought to school because she has to hide that she's a demon. And then yeah, he goes through his school years and they're super overpowered together. Because the cool thing is, though, despite the fact that he is really good at magic, he has a lot of mana. There is a cool thing here in the idea that it's not always like the demon handling the situation, because what she does is she's able to feed off his mana, which requires what typically a succubus would require. Mm-hmm. Kissing, and yes, she says that she can even get it another way a lot better. But she'll take the mana from him, and it's almost like she like brings it upon herself, and then she like amplifies it. So she can give it back to him whenever he's in combat. So whenever there's a situation, it's typically not her handling the situation. She kind of just gives him what he needs to handle the situation. So she's kind of like a mana reserve that amplifies, which is kind of cool. So, but yeah, the main core story around Alto is that he really desires to become one of these shields, and not just any of these shields, but this platinum shield, which is like this high ranking person that's not just high ranking because they're really good, but also because they contribute to the world of magic itself. So that's what he is kind of aiming for, is the top of the top. So your thoughts?
make no bones about it. This is just fun, goofy, kind of etchy. I do like the fact that they're taking it from the kind of Magic Academy side, and they're actually playing around with the concept of, like Andrew was talking about, the summoning aspect, and then at the same time the like Andrew had pointed out, the interesting twist to him was not so much that he was horrible at summoning, it was that he had so much mana
incompatible.
That nobody wanted, or no summon in their right mind would want to be his summon, because he is literally dangerous. So her being a catastrophe is what they kind of implied. They haven't really gotten into her so much outside of the fact that she's a demon, and obviously she's a succubus demon. And then in the synopsis, it says that she's a catastrophe. It's interesting that she's the only one that would take him. And so that leads us to believe there's going to be some interesting story involved in her as he gets to know her a little bit better. So outside of that, it's been fun. The hijinks are, absolutely fun. A lot of the Magic Academy, the interplays between the kind of clubs and all that seem like it could be interesting as he goes up in the ranks later on. So, all in all, it's very interesting. I'm having fun with it. So yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I won't say this show is really doing anything special at all. It is for the most part, just straight up a reason to have some boy walking around with two hot girls, and then, you know, the ecchi stuff ensues. I think the frustrating thing for a lot of people for this being an ecchi show is the idea that the main character is one of those spaz out type of characters. When every time he sees anything inappropriate, he just starts going, oh no, what are these big round things around me? Oh gosh, I gotta get away from this situation. He is kind of one of those types. He's not a go-getter at all. he is as pure boy as you could possibly get, and that technically can frustrate. It's already frustrated me quite a bit. It's like, yeah, okay, this is his archetype. Good on you. Oh, poor you, boy. Oh, poor you. Yes, yeah, poor you. But I say that, but there's some good ecchi here. And it's not something that shows things, but at the same time, it's not one of those ones that has a ton of censorship, because I believe this one doesn't really technically have censorship in the original broadcast. It's just kind of one of those ones where, yes, the hair is perfectly in the right spot to cover up things that they need to cover up. The shots are always in from an angle that you don't really necessarily see anything, but you can, you know, it's left up to your imagination, that kind of ecchi stuff. But I will say, like, the second episode or so with Lilia doing the invisible potion was, like, easily one of the best ecchi scenes in this season, which is funny because everybody's obviously looking at Harem from Labyrinth and Another World as being the pinnacle ecchi show of the season. It's like, well, I've technically got more moments out of Vermil than I've gotten out of that one. Yes, that one shows, you know, the nips and stuff, but that this one seems to be doing a lot better so far. I mean, Harem and Labyrinth and Another World can start getting really raunchy here soon, so we'll have to wait and see. But whereas that one's doing like dungeon crawling and skills and stuff, this one's just straight, you know, overpowered main character or overpowered main duo in against all the odds, essentially. But it's trying to get a little dark with certain aspects of the story for sure, because they obviously imply that Vermil has done something really incredibly terrible in the past, and that's why she was sealed away. I'm curious when they'll eventually get into that, if it's just one of those stupid misunderstandings things. She was trying to help, but she didn't. Or maybe the fact that she is what she is, quote-unquote succubus. She possibly caused troubles with certain groups of people. But that'll be interesting to see once that reveals, if it affects Alto anyway. Probably won't. Also getting into the dragon group or club and how seemingly violent they are. I haven't seen the conclusion of that fight yet, but I'm sure it'll do something interesting. But overall, again, it's kind of just ecchi, harem, love triangle fun at the same time. Has at least a solid driving force for Alto and wanting to become not just the best of the best, but become somebody that contributes to the actual world itself. So we'll see if it turns anything interesting. But so far, I can't really recommend it unless you're just looking for ecchi fun show, because that's really all it's technically doing in the outset. So we'll see where it goes from here, though. That's Vermil in Gold. Check that out if that's interesting to you. Moving on, we have Yurei Deko. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll, run for 12 episodes, done by Science Sorrow. Source is an original. And this one, series composition, is being done by Dai Saito, who did Listeners, Worlds Bubble Up Like Soda Pop, Gits 2045, and Ergo Proxy. And this one takes place on this island, island city, where it seems like anybody that's born on this island, or at least comes there. I haven't really specified if there's other places in this world, just that there's this island. But anybody that's on this island is required to wear these things known as Deko, which Deko can be applied in two different ways, either by surgery to your eyes or by you wearing glasses. But again, everybody is required to wear these Deko. And what Deko are is it's essentially augmented reality. You get your regular vision to see the physical world, but then augmented reality in the Deko will apply this virtual world on top of it, just like augmented reality. And not only that, but it allows you to tap into virtual worlds as well, so you can go into meetings and stuff like that. And the other kind of interesting thing about this particular island is that everything is run by social currency, by likes. So if you do something cool, you help somebody out, you talk to somebody, anything, you can achieve one of these likes from people. They can give you a like, just like social media. And we follow a girl named Berry, who Berry is currently obsessed with this Phantom Zero, which is like doing this game, and obviously not, you know, a good thing, but they're doing this game and she's really wanting to win it because they get a lot of likes. And at some point she ends up running into this boy named Hack because her Deko is malfunctioning. One of her Dekos, one eye, is malfunctioning. So she's able to actually see more of the real world. And this guy named Hack is actually using augmented reality to hide his appearance. He's using a stealth cloak. So since she's not seeing augmented reality in one eye, she's able to actually see him running around, even though he's cloaked to everybody else who's just wearing Deko. This eventually leads to them kind of chasing each other around the town. Eventually, he comes to her place to retrieve something she has of his, and they get pulled into this virtual world where they're attacked by the Phantom Zero. Well, this kind of leads into this explanation about Hack getting arrested, them mentioning the idea of those that are known as Yurei or ghosts, which are people that are not registered in this island. They don't have a Deko, they're not registered, they can't get likes, thus they can't purchase things because you can only purchase things with likes. And so she cooks up a huge plan to get him freed from the... he's having a trial, and so she goes through this whole process of figuring out proof of that he didn't cause it. She goes in there to try to prove his innocence, and then Phantom Zero attacks and they flee anyways, so they didn't mean anything in the end. So that's kind of where we're at right now. Like I said, just kind of mentioning the idea of the likes, the social currencies, the ghosts of this island that aren't registered, and the Deko, and kind of a little bit into this whole kind of issue with the society itself kind of hiding from negativity. So you do have Barry's parents, work at this organization. It's like the central organization that pretty much goes through all their kind of social media setup stuff and deletes and denies anything that's negative. So if somebody hits somebody, they'll get rid of it. If somebody hugs somebody, oh, that's a good thing. Let's keep that on the social media kind of thing. So it's kind of getting into a little bit of the people hiding from negativity in this world. So yeah. Did you ever get a chance to watch this?
No.
Oh, I'm sure you're heartbroken, Chris. We have a longstanding issue with Science Saru, and everybody, there's a group of people that don't like that, but yeah, this I've always been hit and miss on Science Saru, and this is probably going to end up being a mid to almost miss. It's fine, but at the same time, I'm not really enjoying it. Yes, the art style, not my favorite, not my style that I enjoy. It's very kind of messy looking, and Science Saru is very well known for being very messy and very plain looking characters with a lot of animation. And I give them credit for that. I acknowledge what they're doing there. They do a lot of animation. This show is full of animation. They're running constantly. I will argue the action scenes are boring. Like, they're so super boring. It's just mainly characters running constantly, running, things shooting at them, running. And it's pretty much most of this entire show so far has been that. The social media aspect, I think, is a part that I struggle the most with, besides the characters, because this is, I mean, I made it my video. Here we go again. The social media likes are dangerous to society. Society built around social media. This is the evolution of social media, is everybody living off of likes and people seeking likes and betraying people for likes. But I will say that despite the fact that it's got a setup like that with the social currencies, likes, and using that for currency, it hasn't said anything about it yet. So I don't really know exactly yet. And I'm technically already a quarter way through the series. I haven't really figured out what it's trying to say. Because I don't think it's trying to say that it's dangerous to have this as a currency. Because when they have this whole zero disaster where everybody's likes gets reset to zero, they immediately the next day go in and reset them all back to normal. Like, these guys come out with vacuums and they vacuum the likes and the likes return to normal. So I don't see it saying anything there. Yes, it's kind of getting a little bit into the idea of always looking at what is positive, what is always liked, but they have a society in the background that's deleting that which is negative. So it's not a case of people wanting to hide from it, just that the society itself is hiding it. It might end up saying something about that. That's probably the only thing so far where it seems like they're trying to say something. The other thing that I can see them probably trying to get into is with the aspect of the ghosts, people that are outside of the society. People that are outside of quote-unquote social media, trying to survive in a society that is so driven by social media, I can see that probably being the message, because that's what they kind of introduce with the ghosts. Now, the problem that I'm seeing is that they haven't really explained why they can't be registered. Like, is Hack and Finn, these guys that are ghosts, are they ghosts because they don't want to get a deco and get into the system? Do they see that there's a problem with the system and thus they don't want to be a part of it? Are they just not allowed to? Why aren't they part of the system? Is it because they were born under a bridge somewhere? Again, why can't they just go get registered? These are kind of the question marks they're really not getting into quite yet. And they could. That's perfectly fine. They could just be trying to get us into the world and the characters. That's the problem, is the characters so far just really boring. I haven't got anything out of the characters. Barry just runs around saying Lovey every 2 seconds. That's Lovey. This is Lovey. Ooh, that's Lovey. 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 That's all she says. I haven't really got much out of her besides possibly a little bit of a rebellious juvenile kid that's trying to push away her parents. But the parents don't really care, it seemingly. Hack, at the same time, is just very gibberish. That's his thing. His thing is talking gibberish. So I can't get anything out of Fooby Wooby, Poopy Poopy, Jiggy Jiggy. He just says that stuff, kind of stuff all the time, which I feel so bad for the translator that has to translate that stuff. Finn is probably the most interesting character, very mysterious, pops up out of nowhere, seems like they're kind of driven to something. We haven't got too much of Finn, but at least they talk normal, so I'm starting to gather something from Finn. But yeah, I think the biggest issue is the show just doesn't really have characters I care about. They're just kind of just bubbly and weird, and that's about it. So I don't know. I think my biggest issue is that it's revealed a lot about the world. It's set up everything about the world, but it hasn't really done anything with the world or the characters, in my opinion. And I don't care much for the style, the visuals, the music, but it's not terrible at the same time. So we'll see if it turns into anything interesting, but so far it's there, and it's another social media show talking about, it's like old people trying to understand internets. It's always a good thing, right? old writers and directors trying to figure out internets and the dangers of internets, but we'll see. I think Rika Jimmy is supposed to be smiling it, so we'll hopefully that turns into something interesting, but we haven't seen Smiley yet, so... Yeah, that's Yuri Deco. If you're an artsy person, you're probably going to find this to be amazing. So go check it out, because it's artsy, obviously. So, yeah. Ruby, I'm burying myself, so I should walk away. Ruby Ice Queendom, or Ruby Hyosetsu Taikoku. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll. Being done by Studio Shaft. The source is, of course, animated series that was done by Monty Ohm and Rooster Teeth. The director is Kenjiro Okada, who did March Comes in Like a Lion, alongside Toshimasa Suzuki. Series composition and script work is being done by To Ubu Kata, who did Modok Scramble, Psycho Pass 2 and 3, Fafnir Dread Aggressor, and Gets a Rise. And this weird status of plan and animation concept is done by Jinro Butchi, which, whatever that means. This one, essentially, wow, it's been so long since we watched the first three episodes. I watched the fourth episode here yesterday, but I had to kind of remind myself, what are we doing? But no, essentially is like this world where there's these evil creatures and they have to be fought. The Grimms, that's right. There's these Grimms that show up, and so people use hope to create a way of fighting back, and it's basically through this dust, which is this energy source. So they fight against the Grimms, and eventually we follow Ruby, who is this girl that's aspiring to become one of these huntresses to fight against the Grimms. And her sister just recently got accepted to join this academy, Beacon Academy, which trains hunters. And Ruby's really excited for her sister, but at the same time really wants to be a huntress too. She ends up running into a gang that's robbing a dust-selling facility, or a marketplace that sells dust. And she ends up getting accepted to go to Beacon Academy because she fought these dudes and they see potential in her. So her and her sister get on this little plane to go fly over to the academy. They instantly get thrown into a trial where they have to basically form teams and fight survive in this forest, where they end up fighting a really big, huge Grimm. And then they go to the academy, where we're starting to learn about a certain type of Grimm, which is Dream Eater or Dream something? Nightmare. This Nightmare Grimm that basically infects people, and they don't know they're infected. But what it does is it kind of eats at them in their dreams, and eventually they'll go into like this coma state where all of their aura and stuff is just feeding the Grimms and they can't wake up. And we essentially had where Jean, which is one of the Academy members, he went under it, but he was so unable to use his aura that it didn't feed the Grimm enough, so it was easily taken care of. Whereas now, as we wake up into episode 4, we find that Weiss, which is one of the team members of Ruby's team, is infected by one of these nightmares, so Ruby has to go in and beat it up, which, again, I think is technically where it's branching off from the original source, right?
I don't know.
Weiss was never nightmared.
I didn't remember it, her being nightmared in the original show, but I didn't get that far. I'm at the place where I got in the show.
I'm pretty sure it's original, because what I skimmed of the original show, I don't remember it getting into Weiss, so we'll see, though. But, yeah, that's... That's Ruby. So everybody, fights with dust and kills Grimms and trains at an academy. And like I said, they technically have teamed up. So the whole Ruby thing is RWBY, which is Ruby, Weiss, Blake, Block A, and Young, which Young is Ruby's sister. Blake is like a former member of the White Fangs, which is a group of people that has been kind of... It's beast people that have been treated poorly, and... So they're trying to fight back against the system by fighting against the organization that produces the dust. And so they're seen as terrorists, even though they're technically just trying to fight to survive. But yeah, she didn't really like how they were handling things. So Blake basically left them. And Weiss is kind of like this really prim and proper rich girl that is a family member of this group that actually runs the dust producing company. And so there's a little bit of a rivalry between the two of them, because one is a family member of that company. One is somebody that used to attack the company. So your thoughts.
I'm actually really enjoying this. I love the fact that we're seeing it from a different type of animation. And I really, really am loving, the stuff that they're that Shaft is doing to kind of capture the essence of the original Ruby, and at the same time, you know, kind of just go all out in a lot of cases. The first three episodes were absolutely fantastic. The fourth one, I did see some things that I was like, that seems a little bit weak. But at the same time, I thought it looked really fantastic for a very action heavy episode. There was a lot of really cool scenes up inside there. This is one of the things that when I was originally talking about Ruby and my what I disliked about it and what I did love about it. One thing that I've always loved about Ruby is their action scenes. They're absolutely fantastic. And that translates over into 2D animation absolutely fantastically as well. Ruby doing a lot of her spin twirl things and the kind of gung fu
semblance.
Yeah, and her semblance and her gung fu all tied up in what she's doing. A lot of that stuff is really cool to see. And I think they're doing a fantastic job.
I got a huge kick out of the fact that when she went into Weiss's dream world, everything that she's equipped with is what Weiss believes it is. So when she takes out her weapon to use it, which is like this really big, like, rapier, and on one side it's able to, it has a blade and it has a gun in the middle of it, or like a barrel in the middle of it. And so when she goes to shoot at something, it shoots the other direction. She's like, dang, I got to talk to Weiss after this and let her know that it goes the other way. Like, she doesn't know how it shoots. So I thought that was kind of cute. A little nice little attention to detail to create some comedy.
I think technically she's never seen her fight, right?
She's seen her fight because they fought the big gigantic Grimmcrow.
Ah.
So, yeah. I don't think she shot it, though. I mean, maybe she did, but again, she didn't see it. But she probably knows it shoots. She just doesn't. She's never seen where it shoots out of. I guess the thing there. So, but no, it's I really did enjoy the first three episodes. We got the first three episodes like super early, which sucked because it took an entire month before we got the next episode. And I think the thing that I noticed coming out of the three episodes,
the scene missing.
The thing that I got out of the three episodes is this is a really incredible job. The animation is really fantastic. Yes, there's more scenes in the original version because I think a lot of that was around the action. They did really cool action choreography and stuff in the original one. And I think they were trying to capture most all those scenes here. I did notice when I was kind of looking at a comparison or comparing it myself by looking at episodes of the original Ruby, it did seem like a lot of the action scenes were a little bit shorter. But at the same time, I kind of agree with certain. I would argue that there's some cases where I feel like shorter is better because sometimes it just drags out too much. I was highly disappointed to see that one scene on the dock was completely cut, and I knew it because when I watched the third episode, and suddenly it just cuts to, it's like, okay, something's happening on the dock, and then it cuts to the whole situation's done. It's like, wait, something obviously happened there. And so I checked it out. I'm like, yeah, sure enough, this incredible action scene was completely skipped. So I was a little bit bummed about that. So I can feel, you know, huge fans of Ruby probably being disappointed with the lack of certain action scenes. But at the same time, I do like how things are a lot more condensed, and how it's being laid out so far has been really incredible. The directing's great. Again, the action scenes that they have done are fantastic. I feel like Weiss's character development has been kind of wishy-washy for me. I think that's if you ask me one thing that I would be most critical about this so far, I don't understand Weiss. Like, they're not playing her character right. And I think it's because they're trying to rush into this scenario. It doesn't make any sense. Like, it starts out with Weiss being, I'm better than everybody else. I tried super hard. I got myself here. Everybody else is beneath me. To, okay, now I know that Blake is a part of this group that is attacking my family's business. I think she's terrible. Oh, well, never mind. I don't care anymore. I'm just not going to think about it. To, now Ruby is going into her mind. Wait. You just said in the previous episode when it's happened to Jean, it only people that are truly trusted by the mind can be allowed in. So Jean, obviously being in a relationship with Pyra, he's going to let her in. Why is Weiss allowing Ruby into her mind? She hates her. She's always hated her. And she hasn't she hasn't done anything to gain her trust. Why would she be allowed in? So they're setting up things and they're breaking their own rules, and I think they're not handling Weiss's character right. I do like her character, and I hope that they do something cool with it, but it feels like things are going a little bit too fast for what they've set up so far. But other than that, it's good action. I'm enjoying a lot more than I thought I would, honestly. I think the setup's been pretty solid so far, and it has potential in the future. So it is technically just, here's the bag, monsters, go to academy to train. But underneath, it's got some cool mechanics and stuff that they're doing cool stuff with.
Yeah, I was only going to throw in that the missing scene from the dock was discounting one of my favorite characters with Penny. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with the Penny thing, but I thought Sun in that scene was, amazing. Cool, like, too, he had this cool little, like, nunchuck chain gun thing, and he was just swinging around like nunchucks, but then it would, like, shoot off bullets. It was like, oh, my, I would love to have seen Shaft deal with that. But I do agree, like, with the... I will say episode four... it was very artistic for the most part. Really cool seeing the inside of her mind. Obviously, everything seems to be so centered around her parents, the company. Everything's driven by the company. She feels this necessity to be a part of the company and serve it well. So you see a personification of what she's going through. That everything is so much about this dust and everything and the company. But the struggle was, like, towards the later part, suddenly Ruby, you know, runs into this figure, which we don't know who possibly is Weiss or not Weiss. Runs into this figure, and then they start fighting. And it's just like, I realized that point, this is probably the norm for the show. Like, this is, like, episode 1-3 was them going crazy and selling you on the show. And it was pre-released. It looked really polished. And now this is the norm. This is what Shaft is going to be doing with the show. And I honestly, you could disagree, it's fine. This is normal for me for Shaft. Shaft always starts really strong. And then you get into the norm, and then they just kind of just do enough. And that's, they always stick with artistic, but the actual animation action, it's always kind of like shrug. There's always these points where they'll put like the extra effort into it, which is perfect. I completely agree, but this is the norm. And so I'm kind of glad I watched the fourth episode, because that kind of set my expectations. This isn't going to look amazing like the first three episodes throughout the entire series. This is probably going to be the norm. So, which, I mean, I give him credit, because most of the episode was a lot of different perspective shots. There's a lot of sceneries that was changing. She's constantly moving around the environment. So that, you know, it was the majority of the episode was her running around. So I can see them kind of pulling back the reins a little bit for the ending part. So anyways, I'm looking forward to it. I think Ruby's a great character. Love her Seiyu. She's already sold on me just by her Seiyu alone, but I enjoy Yang. They haven't really done anything with Yang. I think she's the only one that they really haven't touched at all. Blake, obviously, having a lot of conflict in her past. I'll be interested to see what they do with the White Fangs and Blake, if they do. And again, technically, Weiss seems to be the focus right now. The PVs seem to make her the focus. The Ice Queendom thing. Everything seems to point at this being about Weiss, so... That is, I think, the biggest concern I have, is that since I'm already kind of struggling with Weiss and how they're progressing her character so quickly and not making much sense, does make me concerned for the overall show when I'm already feeling that in four episodes. But I'll hold judgment. I'm enjoying it. It's very entertaining. So we'll see where it goes from here. Ruby, Ice Queendom. Oh, yeah. Ling Tosite is involved, which is great. Liquidus Recoil is our next one. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 13 episodes, done by Studio A1 Pictures. The source is original. The genres are action, comedy, slice of life. And this is written by the creator of Bento, which is Asa Ura. So, good stuff there. But this one basically takes place in kind of a Tokyo setting. It feels a little bit semi-futuristic, but it's pretty modern time Japan. And at some point, we follow a girl named Takina, and she is currently being deployed as one of these Liquidus, which we find out in this particular setting, there is these girls known as Liquidus who are orphan children that are raised by this company to be basically assassins. So if there's a threat, if they register that there's a threat happening, the girls will kind of go there undercover and take out the threat. And then the organization itself will cover it up. So nobody will know that happened. So they have this whole opening sequence where you have people opening up bags and there's explosives inside of it. And then suddenly this schoolgirl walks by and takes out this silence gun and goes, pew, pew. It's like that crazy kind of stuff. But we follow Takina. She's one of these Liquidus. She's being deployed at this kind of arms deal that's happening. And while she's being told in order to stand down, she takes out this huge gun and just mows down all these bad guys. Even though her partner is technically inside that room and could have been hit. So, yeah, they're not too happy about it. They end up transferring her to this other location called Lico Rico. And it's a small cafe that's run by this guy, Mika, who is a previous member of the headquarters, the DA office. And he has one Liquidus under him, which is Tisato. And so you have this whole situation where Takana, being pretty much kicked out of the main headquarters, is really upset, and she wants to figure out how she can get back to the DA, all the while having to work alongside Chisato, which is fine because Chisato is, like, really well known as being, like, highly skilled. She was recognized for her efforts in this whole attack on this tower. But so Takana and Chisato work alongside each other. They're trying to figure out what happened with that whole arms deal, while at the same time handling different situations. And the oddity about Chisato is that she is all about non-lethal. So anytime there's a situation, a fight or something like that, she uses non-lethal, takes down the targets without killing them. Whereas Takana, she's kind of struggling with this because Liquorice are basically given the license to kill. And so she doesn't see why Chisato is going out of her way in order to not take down their targets. So that kind of goes for a little bit. Eventually, they start getting into some possible conspiracies behind the backgrounds of why Takana was kicked out of the DA. There's possibly somebody pulling strings, eventually getting into Chisato. What's her driving force? What's she seeking? And the seemingly somebody working behind the scenes to kind of get a band together is my theory so far. Your thoughts on Liquorice Recoil?
I absolutely love it. Between the characters in general, I really love the characters. The action scenes are absolutely fantastic. I really, really love...
Did you hear how long it took him to get that out?
Yeah, that's the intensity of my...
Fantastic.
Love how Chisato does a lot of her kind of, like Andrew was mentioning, the non-lethal, and she the way she moves around and does her takedowns and her dodging bullets. This show is absolutely awesome. The artwork looks great. The animation is great. I mean, top tier show for sure.
I was really afraid that he wouldn't like the show because they killed off Kurumi, but apparently that did not upset him too much because it is Tama. So if they kill Kurumi and it's Tama, then he's not going to enjoy the show. You did watch the last episode, right?
I'm guessing not.
I'm joking. I'm joking. Yeah, of course Chris is going to love this show. It's got Tama, though there's not enough Tama in it. So
this is true. She's cooped up in her little box most of the day.
Cooped up in the bath, yes. And the box, that too. Anyways, no, I highly agree. This show is easily probably my favorite of the season right now. It's easily for new shows. It's going to be hard for me to say versus shows that are returning, obviously, like Made in Abyss and stuff like that. That's a toughie. But as a new show, hands down, this is easily my favorite of the season. And if it keeps up the way that it is, it's going to be a contender for Anime of the Year for me because I'm loving it that much. Now, why? Visually, yes, A1 Pictures is dumping some beautiful art in this thing. Budget, whatever you want to call it, this show looks fantastic. The character designs are fantastic. They keep on model. They look great. They're great character designs. I love it. It seems like there's somebody that works behind the scenes that is very into fashion because they like to show these characters in different outfits. A lot of the kind of the commercial cuts will have a lot of different outfits. It does seem like somebody has some style that's working on this project. Now, outside of that, the next part is the animation. Yes, looks great. I haven't really seen anything that's really been like that looks a little rough. Maybe the only thing that I can really think of is the CGI car part. They were trying to flee in this car, and it kind of that CGI kind of stood out a little bit, but that was very brief. For the most part, everything else has been fantastic. And now the thing that sets us apart from most all action scenes, and I've said this, I feel like I'm a broken record. I'm sorry for those that have watched my videos. I keep talking about this. This is how you do action scenes. It's not just, okay, these girls obviously use weaponry, bullets and stuff like that. So they're going to be hiding behind cover fire and shooting at the bad guys that are shooting at them. No, it doesn't do that. It's not just take cover and shoot back and forth. This is like there's steps to the combat. There's sequences that it's going through. It's like I've mentioned before, it's almost like an orchestrator that's orchestrating a big ensemble of instruments. So you have, like, for instance, in the second episode, Takana coming into this room behind Chisato. They take fire. She hides behind this briefcase, and she starts kind of leaning left and right to shoot behind the briefcase. Chisato flanks to the right, jumps over this shelf, fires from above. They go to this whole scene inside the hallway. Chisato kicks somebody's grenade inside of a door, closes the door, throws a person from the door so they get knocked out. It's just there's so many little intricacies to the combat. It's not just simple shoot back and forth. There's something happening, and it's always twisting and turning with the combat, and it's so super entertaining. Whoever is behind, like, setting up these sequences needs massive amounts of credit, and they keep doing that with each action scene. Even this, the fight, the mock fight that they had at the DA, just kind of this whole thing where she's trying to teach this Kohai how to do her work while she's fighting. Oh, you're too close. Grabs the gun, pulls it away, dislodges the chamber. That kind of stuff is so cool. They do a great job with the action scenes. Now, that's what I was thinking with the first couple episodes. Like, this is going to be a show with great character interactions, fun character interactions, and just really great action scenes. Episode 3, and on into episode 4, sold me that this writer is absolutely incredible with characters. I have never seen character writing this good in a show in so long. And why it's so incredible is because it feels natural and it has steps to it. This isn't, Chisato saves Takina's mother and thus Takina falls in love with Chisato. This isn't, we get into this deep backstory about Takina and this burning building, and Chisato was actually a childhood friend that pulled her from the burning building. This is, the characters are in the now, and Chisato says the right words that Takina needs. In the third episode, it really does get into how, like I mentioned before, this organization is essentially their parents. They're orphans, they had no family, they're brought into the organization, they're raised, they're trained, they're given clothes, they're given a place to stay. Chisato kind of hits on this idea of, I remember this place, I knew you'd be here because all of the Liquidists love this place. It's like this fountain. And she talks about how, I so looked forward to the day that I would wear the uniform, because that's what they all look forward to. Oh, we all look forward to the day that we get to live in the dorms in the DA. That's what they all look forward to. This is their home. This is their family. And Takina technically has been kicked out. And even though she goes to the commander and says, look, I found proof. The commander's like, I never told you can come back. It's almost like her own parent is saying, you can't come back home. And it dawned on me at that point, like, okay, that's right. They're technically orphans. This is all they had. But it was great because they had this moment where Chisato's telling her, look, you have a place to be. Try it out. Try to hang out with everybody at the cafe. Try to have some fun. And if you still don't like it, you can come back. We'll find you an opportunity to get back into here. It was almost like Chisato allowing Takina to choose what she wants to choose, that she'll accept whatever she chooses, but she's giving her an out and saying that she is happy that she exists. She's happy that she met Takina, showing her that somebody wants her.
Yeah.
And it was enough to open the door for Takina. And I kind of mentioned it as an idea that Chisato right there made a chip in her armor. Opened up a little bit. And then as you get in the fourth episode, he's having this very natural scene with the two of them going out, going to this aquarium. Chisato opening up a little more about why she's non-lethal, how she doesn't like taking away the years that people have. And then it gets to this point where Takina finally realizes Chisato's uncomfortable with the conversation. And so she goes over and she breaks the conversation by acting like a fish. And I was like, that was so natural. And it was so embarrassing for Takina. And it was such a great scene because we finally seen Takina, that armor broke open. Like that thing that was blocking her from being a kid, being having fun, it finally broke open. And like I said, the way that it plays out so naturally, and it feels like a bunch of dumb kids just having fun. And I loved it so much. And to add to the fact that it looks so gorgeous, and yes, technically the entire episode is about boxers versus Ponzu, which is hilarious. The writing's incredible. And I so hope, I keep saying like every episode I do an impressions video, because I've been doing impressions videos for this on our YouTube channel. Every time I go into an episode, I'm expecting that I'm not going to have anything to talk about. Oh, this is just an action show. But no, the writing is so good. And it's so natural. And it's so fun. The comedy's on point. The characters are on point. Everything just leads me to believe that this is pretty much a perfect rounded show that I'm just thoroughly enjoying. So,
I want to compound on what
don't,
Andrew was
don't
mentioning.
Do it. Make sure what you Andrew drag that word out again.
Fantastic. No. I really did, going with what Andrew was saying, I absolutely agree. The contrast between Chisato opening and saying there's a place that you are wanted, and Takina seeing the DA headquarters and how they are just absolutely denying her any acknowledgement of wanting her in any way, shape, or form. It places this thing on Takina of, where do you want to be? Because you have a place that wants you, loves you, and wants to bring you in. And these people who are truly looking at you like you are the garbage of society, and look, they've already replaced you with somebody else. All this stuff is just playing out in a really fantastic way.
We got a new daughter. Don't worry about it. You can leave, daughter. like I said, it doesn't really get into it. Like, it doesn't get into Takana's mind like she's that way. What was interesting is they chose to have Chisato sort of give her the words, because Takana doesn't like to talk. So it makes sense that Takana wouldn't go, "This was my family. I lost everything." No, instead, because she's so quiet, because she's so to herself, because she doesn't want to express herself, Chisato has to kind of say it. And that's what I kind of felt was interesting about how they told that story.
Even at the fountain, when like Andrew was saying, Chisato saying, "Look, I understand. Everybody likes this place. This is where you come to get that uniform." And then Takina, in this, like Andrew was saying, she's kind of awkward and she doesn't speak a lot. When she does have this emotional breakdown and say, "Then you understand. You know why I want to be here." And I thought that interplay was really fantastic, and it just shows the difference in the. I mean, Takana to me is an absolutely fantastic character. I really have loved to see her development over the.
She's the overly serious, long black haired girl that I don't hate. That tells you something.
She's absolutely like Andrew was saying, these little chinks in her armor where she's breaking a little bit of that. Kudere kind of character archetype of just slowly warming up. It really, really works well for the way this story is working. Like we were talking about with Chisato and her adherence to being non-lethal, and Takina's like, "Why do you keep doing this? This is what we were trained and we were brought up to be. Murderers, and we're this is normal. Why are you doing everything that is not normal?" So I love the way that they're playing into each other so well. I love it.
I love the boxer stuff though. That was great. That was so great. She's like, "No, those are not pantsu. Those are boxers. Those are guys' things. Where'd you get those?" "Oh, Mika told me that these are very comfortable." And like, I like how she tries them on later and says, "Oh yeah, these are really breathy and comfortable." But no, it has this whole thing where she's like, "You know, we're going out tomorrow." And she's like, "Oh, is this a mission?" She's like, "No, we're getting pantsu. But make sure you wear some casual clothes." And she leaves, and then she turns immediately to Takana, just like before, turns to Mika. "I need casual clothes. What should I wear?" And he just kind of lifts his head like, "Oh, gosh." Like the character writing, like I said, the interactions are just so well written.
That's another thing. It's like Takina preferring the boxers is functional. She explained
it. She's like, "Are there pantsus? Is there lingerie that is for battle gunfights?" And she's like, "Yeah, of course there's." "No, there's not." Like, I'm like thinking, "Oh, there's lingerie for battles." I guess technically they are. I mean, I've seen some shows where it's got the spy lady and she pulls there's a holster in the underwear kind of thing. But no, I don't think that works, Tucker.
Okay, we got to stop with the gushing.
Gotta move on. Half this podcast episode, we'll be about to talk about Licorice the Coil. I mean, that tells you something. That tells you something. There's so much to talk about in a show that's not about like some deep plot line. I mean, there is a plot line there. There is the fact that Takana is being forced out on purpose. The commander knows that somebody's trying to force her out, and she can't say anything. They got hacked, and that's not normal. So yeah, Licorice the Coil. Moving on. My stepmom's daughter is my ex. Let's move on to more fantastic shows. Mama haha no sure go ga motokano data. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 12 episodes, being done by Studio Project Number 9. The source is light novel. The genres are comedy and romance. This one directing is being done by Shinsuke Yanagi, who did Angel 3P, Never a Girl Online, and Ryo's work is never done. And series composition by Hitomi Moino, who's done a ton of stuff, including Snow White with Red Hair and Flying Witch. So, yeah. So, as the title would lead you to believe, this opens up with two siblings, Mizuto and Yume. They used to be boyfriend-girlfriend when they were younger, and apparently some kind of collected amount of issues they were having, eventually they decided to separate. Well, jump forward, and now their parents, surprisingly enough, met each other and got married, so now they are siblings, and they have to hide the fact that they were once going out together and try to be the perfect siblings in front of them, because they want their parents to be happy, seemingly. And they ended up getting forced to go to the same school and everything. So that's, that was going to happen. You knew that was going to happen. Eventually gets into the concepts of their previous relationship, their issues they have with each other, and pretty much this game that they're having between each other, which if somebody shows some sign of not being siblings, they have to, they can force the other person to do something. So, as they go to school, a couple things they kind of address is the idea that Yume is trying to change her life. Before, she was a bookworm. That's how they met in a library. She was a bookworm, braided hair, glasses, the usual nerd girl thing. Now she wants to become more active. She wants to get out more, make friends. And so she's obviously changed her appearance quite a bit, obviously taking the attention of a lot of men. They all know that they're related. So there's a lot of boys that are trying to use Mizuto, become his friend just so they can get close to Yume. This bothers her. He doesn't care. Eventually, Yume meets her first friend, Akatsuki, who we find out is madly in love with Yume. So that's going to be interesting going forward, see how that goes. but yeah, it's pretty much them trying to pull tricks on each other. Yume often trying to get Mizuto to break the sibling thing and become attracted to her, but then he ends up just kind of turning around on her somehow, blowing it up in her face. Like one time she decides to, well, he didn't react to the fact that I grabbed his arm and pressed my chest against it when I told everybody that I was a bro con to, just to help him out. So let me go out with just a bathrobe. And then she goes, or bath towel. And she goes out there with a bathrobe, just a bath towel on, and ends up realizing, wait, I'm seducing him, and gets completely flustered, tries to leave, falls over. And then he's like, well, I'm going to lose just this one day, and starts to get close to her. And then the parents come home. That kind of stuff, because ecchi fun. Your thoughts on My Stepmom's Daughter Is My Ex?
This is one of the ones that I couldn't catch up on. I got about two
really?
Episodes in. Yeah,
of this, all the shows, this is the one that you did get caught up
on.
How
well, I caught up on. Well, I'm working on a couple of cuckoos. Oh my gosh, you got me so messed up on that. A couple of cuckoos, and I caught up on another one. I know that you
Summertime Rendering. You finally got caught up on
not yet.
What?
I told you I was going to try and see if I can get that one in.
Gosh.
But I there was another one that we ended up letting slip by, and I've completely caught
up. Ashi or Love Live?
Oh, Classroom of the Elite.
Oh.
And so this one was one of the ones that kind of start one week got behind, and then the next week, and it's like I'm not that far behind. It's just it's one of the ones that slipped through the crack. The first two episodes, though, however, I really I'm not going to say I like this show. I'm in this kind of weird nebulous area of this is a trash fire. The two main characters are absolutely in complete self-denial about how they feel about each other. And it's like, I want to watch it just because I want to see if they actually ever kind of figure out what they're going to do with each other. So I'm in this weird area of, I think I like it, but I'm not sure right now because I don't know that I'll ever be able to acknowledge my true feelings about this show, because it's in a weird area of, I'm not sure. I think it might be fun. But yeah, as it stands right now, I can fully acknowledge how much of a weird show this is, for sure.
I mean, it's obviously hitting on the incest thing, but at the same time, it's one of those struggle ones where it's like, typically when you have these kind of shows or this concept of the relationship between siblings, it's always like, you know, either they've been siblings for a while, but you find out later they're not actually blood related, or it's they were brought together a long time ago. It's always kind of you have a time period they've been existing together. This is like at the point in which they become siblings, so it's a little more differently to think about, because they don't have that attachment as siblings for a long time living together, and so it kind of changes the spectrum a little bit, but still falling in the category of, yeah, you kind of don't need to be in a relationship anymore because now you're in legal terms siblings. So it's a little more harder to fight against and have that struggle with. Like, typically people talk about, I've had a sister for, you know, 20 years of my life, and I think that's creepy or whatever. This is kind of a little bit different story because, again, they've technically been in a relationship before. Now, I will say my thoughts on the show.
I can't
so
wait
far.
Until they reveal that the reason that they had to break up was because they murdered somebody, you know.
What?
No, I just playing on our thing of before where they can't let something trivial
go. Oh, some deep thing that passed. Yes, I'm following where you're joking with that. I would be interested. Like I said, they've stated that it was a compounding amount of different issues. So it's like, what was the thing that broke the camel's back? I guess is going to be the thing. Because I mean, it was obvious that she was like super introvert, creepy with him. Like, because she kept everything of his. Like, she kept it all in a box. Which was kind of creepy. Like, Yume in general is kind of creepy. Creepy in a good way. She's like the Yandere creepy, where she like, it seemed like she was overly secretively weird about things. And this is stuff that he's now finding out. Like I said, the whole thing where everything that she gave him, she would keep in a box. So if he gave her a pencil to use, she put it in a box. Eraser, she put it in a box. She was that about that. Whereas now it's kind of changing that a little bit, but still kind of revealing those issues. I will say, like, overall, I'm mixed on the show. Like, I don't mind if it goes in the route of the whole incest thing. It doesn't bother me. But at the same time, I don't know that they are. That's the weird thing. It obviously seems like there's a physical tension there, especially with the first episode, him falling on top of her and saying, I'm going to lose this one time. She's obviously trying to use her body to get him to break. There's obviously a physical tension there. But my curiosity that comes is as it went along, and I think the whole thing with Akatsuki really did derail my thoughts on the show. As it went along, it really did feel like we were going into a realm of them just realizing that they care for each other, which is what I was kind of thinking would be an interesting way for it to go. Because it's obviously there's two different routes they can go. One route is that eventually them living together and trying to be siblings, eventually they realize what was so special about each other and forgetting about the things that they didn't like about each other. She obviously hates the fact that he's so wishy-washy. He'll often change his personality to fit to throw her off. And she doesn't like that he's so willing to act like his old charming self just for the sake of throwing her off. But they're starting to realize the things that they do like about each other. They're reflecting on what they did like about each other and how much they did care about each other. And I'm curious if they'll take away the physical nature of we have to be in love and kiss to I just like you as a person. Let's be strong siblings. Or is it going to go the route of them realizing all the stuff that they liked about each other and then eventually being in secretly having a relationship, which obviously because how much the world of Japan loves sibling love, probably going to go in that route. But I would be kind of surprised if they did go the route of it just being them being naturally in love with each other as siblings because they like each other as people and not be physical about it. But I think the moment that Akatsuki's whole thing got revealed, I'm like, no, we're just going to go straight incest stuff. This is what the writer wants to do. Because at some point they reveal that Akatsuki, who is Yume's first friend, is like super into Yume. Like she wants to marry Mizuto because she wants to be at Yume's side all the time. Like she is giving up her entire future to marry Mizuto just so that she always, because obviously I just to inform people, because some people out there do not know this. When you marry somebody, you always live with their siblings. Because anytime you marry somebody, you live with their family 24/7. So that's Akatsuki's mindset, is that if I marry Mizuto, I will always get to be with Yume. I think it would be probably better if she tried to marry Yume, but they won't accept that. But they will accept having Yume live with Mizuto for the rest of her life. But anyways, that's the direction they're going with Akatsuki. And that, it's funny, but at the same time, it threw me off because it really did feel like the show did have a sense of wholesomeness in there. Yes, it's got the whole sibling love thing, but there is a little bit of wholesomeness in there. Like, Yume going out of her way to insult herself by saying she has a bro-con thing just because she didn't like the fact that these guys were essentially bullying Mizuto by being his friend to get to her. She didn't like it. She didn't like him being used. She didn't like Mizuto being used. Getting into Yume getting sick, being a little delusional in her sickness, and then at some point realizing she's getting better, but she keeps acting like she's sick in order to get Mizuto to dote on her. Those are some really cute moments they kind of have sprinkled in there, again, to show that these two could possibly just like each other's existence and not necessarily has to go into the route of them being in love, but it could. So it kind of bounces back and forth for me. I think it's a solid show. It's not really doing anything. I would argue it's not doing enough to be as trash fire as I would have kind of assumed it was going to be from the very beginning. The first episode felt very trash fire. But it hasn't really been, it hasn't been playing off the sibling lust thing too much. The whole incest thing. It hasn't been really playing off that as much as I thought it would be. But that could change. So we'll have to see.
But yeah. I was only calling it trash fire because of the self-denial.
Yeah. It could easily go that direction. I think, again, with Akatsuki's reveal, I think it probably could go down that route. Because now they have to date each other. And yeah. We'll see. But yeah, my stepmom's daughter is my ex. I mean, technically, from the very beginning when we first came into it, I was like, yeah, this is going to be... You think rent a girlfriend's bad, this is probably going to be worse. But it's no. It's
oh,
not.
No.
It's nowhere
no.
near.
Uh-uh.
Rent a girlfriend has its own issues. That has nothing to do with incest
or anything. See, I actually like these characters. Rent a girlfriend is in a whole nother realm.
Yeah, Mizuto is not unlikable like the main character of Rent a Girlfriend. Moving on, Chibi-Mo. This one is streaming on HIDIVE, running for 12 episodes, being done by Shinny Animation. Source is original. The genres are comedy. And this one follows three people in this household. I think, yeah, Mutsumi, Mei, and Hazuki. And they all live together at this house. And at some point, these little creatures show up. And they're really cute. They almost look like, I don't know, like a blob. And at some point, it kind of goes to this whole episode where everybody keeps saying... you know, this thing's like hell. Like, this, the heat is like hell. And every time that they would say it, these little creatures would go over and summon more of them. And then at some point, even though they're, like, trying to find out who the owner is to this creature, they don't even know what the creature is, at some point they just have, like, a bunch of these things just appearing in this house out of nowhere. Eventually, this creature from the hell, which they end up calling Jigoku, he ends up showing up to get all of his minions and to destroy them. And quickly... Mutsume gets really angry because he realizes that these things belong to him and that he abandoned them, and she takes his club away and then, like, just pretty much beats him. So he tries to find a job because he's supposed to, like, observe the humans, and he tries to find a job, fails miserably. These girls end up allowing him to stay at their place inside the shed, but they give him a place to stay. and yeah, they show him things of this world. Like I said, he's technically supposed to be observing the world. He can't go back empty-handed, so he's just staying there and observing what they do. They go this whole process of cooking things and teaching him how they cook things, and that's terrifying because, yes, technically, if you explain how sausage is made, it's pretty terrifying. They take body parts from animals, they put it through a grinder that grinds it up, and then they put it inside of intestines of animals, and then they cook it. So... if you think about that, that's extremely terrifying. So that's terrifying. But he realizes it's delicious. So they went through the whole process of cooking things, him saying how terrifying it is, but then liking what it tastes like. So that's pretty much Chibi-Mo. Yeah. It's all right. So far, it's all right. I think Chris hasn't watched this one, right?
No. I was thinking about checking it out because people were excited about it.
I will say it's very wholesome. It's very fun. It's very cute. And again, it has kind of a little bit of twisted humor in there. Like I said, with the whole grinding meat and him being terrified at what they're doing, getting a job and how difficult it is to get a job and the processes and the mannerisms that he has to learn about getting a job. Always having some sort of punchline at the end that kind of bookends the different jokes. I will say that the three sisters, I think they're sisters. I don't think the Mutsumi's her mom. I might be wrong. I think they're sisters, though. These three girls are just a lot of fun. And I mentioned it today on Discord. I'm like, I technically equate them to almost like March Comes in Like a Lion. It's like a very wholesome group of girls living in a house and bringing some guy in to show him the wonders of the world. Again, not to like the writing levels of March, because this is more of a comedy, laid back family type show. It does have that little wholesomeness to it. So I do enjoy the characters. It's very laid back. It's not trying to do anything really fantastic, but they're just kind of a fun little group to get around with and hang out with. And the shenanigans that Jigoku gets into because he doesn't understand the world that he's in. He's definitely a fish out of water story. So it's like family, wholesomeness, fish out of water guy added to the mix. And then just these kind of little shenanigan moments between the characters. It's not, again, not doing anything incredible. It's visually fine. It's got its own unique art style to it. Again, very much so... like a Japanese family show just out of nowhere that's not really doing some big story. So, yeah, it's fine. It's not doing anything incredible. There's some people on Discord that are really crazy about it. But I'm glad they're having so much fun with it. It's not doing anything incredible to me, but it's fine. It's fine, honestly. I'll probably watch the rest of it just because it's very wholesome, very, very laid back, so... Yeah, some of the jokes got kind of repetitive, though, because, like, they spent, like, an entire episode of him learning about foods and saying how terribly they're put together and then going, oh, this is really delicious at the end. It's like, okay, yeah, we've done this like 3 times now. Can we please move on? We don't need to keep killing this joke. We get the layout of this joke. You don't need to show the joke again so that we get the idea of the layout. Oh, this food's made very terribly if you think about it. And then, oh, yeah, but it's still delicious in the end. So that's Chimimo. Check that out if that's interesting to you. Tokyo Mew Mew Mew. This one is streaming on High Dive. We don't know how long it's running for. I think somebody said that it was supposed to be running for a single core for now. Maybe a split core or something like that, hopefully. Being done by Studio Yumita Company and Graphinica. The source is a manga. The genres are adventure, comedy, fantasy, mahou shoujo, romance, sci-fi. The director is Takahiro Natori, who did Aria, The Benediction, and Crypt School. I'm butchering that, I know. Series composition by Yuka Yamada, who did Miss Kobayashi Dragon Maid and Wataten. And of course, yes, the original writer, creator is Reiko Yoshida, who's known for doing a lot of Kyoani works, as well as some work with Science Sara with Hike Story, alongside Naoko Yamada. So, really awesome writer there. So, anyways, yes, this is, of course, a readaptation of the manga. We had an anime adaptation quite a while back, like in the 2000s, I want to say. This, of course, is one of the ones that I've mentioned before, is technically like my Sailor Moon. This one in Cardcaptor Sakura and Shugochara was my Sailor Moon. It is a magical girl show that basically follows a girl named Ichigo. She's starting a new year in school. She's looking around and seeing that everybody, like, romance is blossoming. Like, we're at that age. Everybody's got girlfriends and boyfriends, and she wants a boyfriend bad. Eventually, they spotlight this kendo, this person that practiced kendo, which is Aoyama. And Aoyama is very popular with the girls, and so even though Ichigo kind of immediately falls in love with him, everybody's like, you know, that's kind of out of your league. But eventually, she gets word that he likes, he's really into preservation of animals, extinction, animals that are facing extinction. So she, through the help of Mint, in this adaptation, through the help of Mint, gets some tickets to take Aoyama to a kind of a exhibit on animals that are going extinct. And so he quickly agrees because it's something that he's into. They go there, end up finding out that this is like all an elaborate plan for this organization to bring Ichigo along with these other 4 girls to one location so they can zap them with this big, huge thing that alters their DNA to have some sort of animal that is very rare getting into their DNA and allows them to become a magical girl. And the reason they need magical girls is because they're fighting against these alien threats that might be facing the world itself. And so Ichigo quickly has to spring into action, take out this chimera that is harming her and Aoyama. And then over time, meet the other Mew Mews to come together to create a team of magical girls to fight against an alien threat that seems to be creating chimeras left and right. It's like they're altering animals and making them fight them. So, your thoughts on the new adaptation? I don't remember if I've ever talked to you about how into Mew Mew you were.
I don't remember how far I got into it, but I do remember seeing all the girls. So, I didn't get the pudding episode in yet, but I was.
You missed pudding's episode.
Yeah, I missed pudding's episode. However, I do want to throw this out there. If you were one of those that watched shows way back in the day, I got so many nostalgia vibes watching that first episode of this one. It was like, I'm sitting here the entire time going, it feels like I'm back in the day watching this show for the first time.
It's like, a magical girl. Like, when was the last time we had an actual, like, legit magical girl?
Yeah.
Sailor Moon Crystal coming back out. But then, like, other than that, that I think White Fox did or whatever.
It's funny because with Sailor Moon Crystal, for whatever reason, maybe it was because they were kind of altering things in a way. I'm not saying that they altered it. They went back to
they cut off the fat.
Yeah, and this one, for whatever reason, it felt like it was just capturing that essence of that original vibe of Tokyo Mew Mew. And so it just felt like I was just watching it again for the first time, and it felt nostalgic. And I don't know how to explain it better than that. But yeah, I absolutely loved it. I love the new kind of cleanup that they technically have done with it by redoing everything again. It feels like it's the new version, or it's a new version of the old classic, just like we said with with Tora, Ushio and Tora. It felt like they took the old show and just revamped it for the newer time frame. And this one is pulling that off as well. It just absolutely just works. I love it.
Yeah, I think that's something they're doing very well. And I kind of mentioned it in my videos talking about how I don't know if it's a good thing for or bad thing for most people. I think most people are pretty on point with it. I was super happy that the first episode, it was like trending on Twitter. There was a lot of excitement around it. It really did kind of remind me that there is a huge fandom of Mew Mew fans out there that appreciate it as much as I did. But I think with Mew Mew, it's definitely was always kind of a different take for the Magical Girls. And obviously I was drawn to it because of the whole, obviously, Animal Girls thing they're going with. Because every time they transform with some sort of added element of the animal that they are infused the DNA. And yes, technically Ichigo and the other girls can as well. If she ever does get excited or emotions get away with her, it will kind of, that catness will come out because she's infused with the cat. So if she's, you know, doki-doking over Ayama, suddenly out of nowhere, these ears pop out of her head and she freaks out. Or she has certain quirks about her. I mean, earlier segment shows her climbing around on roofs and going after fish. So there's a little bit of shenanigans around the cat nature coming out of her. They haven't really done it with any of the other characters. I don't remember if they did with the original anime. I've been having a lot of fun kind of looking at the manga.
I seem to remember that for Ichigo anyway.
Definitely pudding. Definitely pudding. I think she probably did, but yeah. But no, I have been kind of looking at the manga alongside the original adaptation, alongside this one weekly. And the thing that popped up immediately for a lot of people was the fact that they cut Mint's story. In the original one, Ichigo was the first of the Mew Mews. And then they went into talking about how, then they went into her bringing in Mint. And then it went into her going, bringing in pudding, and eventually getting into Zakuro. Mint, lettuce, pudding, and then Zakuro. And obviously in this one, what happens? First episode, Mint's already a part of the organization. She actually helps them bring Ichigo in. So they've already skipped an episode there, a chapter there. They obviously skipped straight to pudding, or lettuce came right after that, obviously, because Mint was already in it. And then they skipped straight to pudding. And it does seem, based on the information card for the next episode, they're going to go straight to Zakuro, which is like,
really?
That's like 11th chapter in the original one.
My wolf girl's getting in early.
Now, they could just be introducing her, because I know that she was introduced kind of early. But if they do get straight into her joining the group, that would mean that they will skip straight to chapter/episode 11 of the original one. So it does look like they're cutting out a lot of, you can't really say filler because a lot of it's in the original manga, but like that in-between stuff, and they're just getting straight to the story. So that does give hope for the idea that this is a readaptation of something that is 50 episodes or so long. How are you going to fit it into a single core? It could be that they're just going to go straight to the story. Again, similar to Sailor Moon Crystal. They cut out all that filler they put into the original anime, the adaptation, and they're going straight to the story beats. So that's you can see that as a positive or negative. I know that a lot of people, that kind of leads me to believe they're trying to capture an older audience, the nostalgia audience, while still kind of serving into, yes, younger audience. And I think that's a good thing, because increasing that pacing, helping it move along quicker, is going to do well for establishing a new audience, in my opinion. And obviously, if this does well enough, captures the audience well enough, it could see more stuff coming from this series. Because obviously, a lot of Magical Girls is merchandising. So, but I've been enjoying it so much right now. Because again, I get the nostalgia beats. I feel that nostalgia. I was really happy to see that, despite the fact that they went out and got a whole new cast. Like, legit, they're new to Seiyus. Like, they went out and they did a call to new Seiyus. They specifically wanted people that did not have experience in voicing. And I was a little bit hesitant. Like, I'm like, whoa, wait. Are they going to even have any experience? They're going to be terrible, right? But no, they pulled it off. Like, every one of these Seiyus has pulled it off so far. I've been sending out tweets every episode for the introduction of, like, Ichigo and Pudding, and tweeting out to them, and they're responding. There's a lot of really... It's like the fandom around this is what I'm enjoying the most. It's like, yes, I love it. It's nostalgic for me. I love what they've done so far. The visual upgrade's been great. Yes, some of the transformations are a lot more basic than the original ones. Like with Mint and stuff. The Mint's always kind of the ballerina girl, so she does a lot of ballerina moves in her transformation. They cut a lot of that stuff out, which kind of sucks. There's a little bit of it in Ichigo as well. But like Pudding, they actually kind of upgraded Pudding's a little bit, which was kind of interesting. But I still enjoy them, and they visually have been upgraded quite a bit. And they've been doing a great job with the animation so far with the show. And I think they hit. Lettuce's story kind of showed me that their new style and their new writing has been kind of improving it a bit, because I think they pulled off Lettuce's story a lot better. And the way they did a lot of the audio cues and a lot of the shots of the experiences she's gone through really did hit on point in this idea of her kind of being self-destructive of herself and letting people use her, which kind of shows me that when it does get to more of the interesting story bits with the series, they could get in some cool stuff, which has me excited. So it's great. I love seeing it back. I admittedly, if you've never watched Tokyo Mew Mew and you don't watch Magical Girls, you probably won't find something here. I'm not gonna sell this on new people that this is gonna be something that's gonna blow your mind. It's just a fun magical girl with great characters and yes, animal ears, which is good too. So yeah, I'm looking forward to more. It's a classic for me, and I think it's a nice little polish they put on it, and I cannot wait for more. So Tokyo Mew Mew. New. Mew 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 Mew. Mew Mew Mew. I've had discussions here and there about the new title, like just putting new at the end of it. But I'm like, yeah, but it sounds cute because it's like Mew Mew Mew.
Yep.
It's cute.
I like caught it too.
I like it. It's Mew 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 Mew. It's hard to not catch. Moving on, we have Maiden Abyss, the Golden City of the Scorching Sun, or Maiden Abyss second season. This one is streaming on High Dive, running for 12 episodes, done by Studio Kinema Citrus. The source is a manga, genres are adventure, drama, fantasy, mystery, and sci-fi. How much do I want to get into this? To give people a rough idea that have never watched Maiden Abyss, please go watch Maiden Abyss.
Pretty much.
Essentially takes place at this kind of island that's kind of surrounding, all the residents are surrounding this big, huge, gaping hole in the earth. And they call this thing the Abyss. This is this huge hole that people will climb down inside. They discover that there's artifacts and stuff down there. So people will travel down in the Abyss, gather things, and bring them back up. Now, the whole weird oddity about this Abyss is they have this thing known as the Curse. And if you go down a certain distance, it's very difficult to come back up because it's almost like if you were to go deep sea diving.
Pressure.
You get this pressure aspect. But it's different because it kind of changes people. It can cause you to die. It can kill you. Yeah, similar to like pressure. But also additionally, some people can see deformations and stuff like that in their bodies. So there's kind of a threat to going deep into this Abyss. But there's these ideas of treasures and the wonders of this Abyss. We follow a girl named Riko, who her mother was one of these people that went down the Abyss. At some point, they received back this book that she wrote a bunch of notes in, and Riko recovered it. And this kind of spurred Enrico to desire to go down there and find out what happened to her mother. So she travels down there, eventually runs into Regu, who is this kind of seemingly a cyborg robot boy. And so he helps her eventually later in the season. We run into one of these residents of the Abyss named Nanashi, getting a Nanashi story, which, yes, broke us all. We had a movie which got into Bondrude and Prushka, which destroyed us all. And then now we're in the second season where seemingly the interesting thing about the second season is we got into this backstory. Like immediately we jump into the story of Wedo Iruko, who is somebody who was traded and sold and eventually was under the master that abused the hell out of her, eventually discovering this broken ship that had this compass on it, claiming that it would lead them to this golden city, which ended up being the Abyss. And so Vito, Iruko, along with a bunch of other people that are basically all slaves.
And we know that it will destroy us all.
We're all forced to go on this voyage to find out where this compass leads to, find the golden city within it. And they arrive there, but at the same time, we're seeing Riko, Nanashi, and Regu arriving at this quote-unquote golden city as well. So we haven't really got too much into what the golden city is, but they've arrived there. They've discovered a group of hollows that are down there, which if you watch the original series, you'll know what a hollow is. I'm not going to spoil that for now. If you watch the series, you know what I'm talking about. So yeah, your thoughts so far, without getting too spoilery, because we are technically in the second season. I don't want to spoil things. I think everybody should please go watch the original series.
Yeah, be aware, it is a very brutal show. So
it's a beautiful show.
Brutal.
Brutal. Oh, brutal. Okay, that makes sense. I thought you said beautiful. It's a very beautiful show.
It is a beautiful show. It is beautiful and brutal.
Brutal,
beautiful. This show, even the last episode, it was like from left field, something happened that it was like,
The balancing?
Yeah, the balancing.
The balancing.
It's one of those things that you know full well what you're going into. And to tell you the truth, I knew I was going to watch it. So I don't even know why I put it off and I put it off and I put it off and put it off. And it was like, okay, fine. I'll get this episode in just so that it's started. And then I won't be so apt to avoid it. It's one of those things that, it is a harsh, it's one of those that there is the harshness of reality in it. And I don't mean reality as it, because it's a very whimsical, we talked about in our original, review of the show, it's impressive how well thought out everything is. And this is it. So there's a harshness to that. That because of the fact that the person who this entire world is coming from has so much attention to detail, they think of how harsh something is in relation to its whimsical nature. So they have this kind of almost thing that's kind of built around the idea of being similar to not the Venus flytrap, but one of those flowers that puts off this scent that attracts the flies to it. It's similar in nature to that, where the adventurers are kind of attracted to this thing, and then at the same time, it's just brutal. It's not something that you take lightly when you go down into this abyss. So there's all that encompassed in this world that is the Abyss world, and I really do love it. And yes, because I know full well how brutal the show is, yeah, I'm a little bit more timid into going into the show, but at the same time, it's worth it in a way. I hate to say it. I don't know how to put it.
Yeah, it's so funny because Riko is like the super embodiment of just go-getter, go, let's go adventure kind of person. She feels like she's kind of out of a young adventure book, just being happy. Let's go lucky. Let's get further down here. Let's discover things. Sugoi, look at all this great stuff. And I always kind of feel like I'm her in a sense, in the idea that when I'm watching the show, I go, I want to see more. I want to see what this creator makes. Okay, the next layer of the labyrinth, this stuff looks crazy. What does this thing do? What does this thing do? And then you come to find out, oh yeah, everybody's dying. Like it does that, like, oh wait, this is a really bad situation. Suddenly we're having to cut off somebody's arm, and I don't want this to happen, and we're watching it and we're gritting our teeth at what's happening on the screen. It's terrifying. And then it does that. It has a knack for pulling off, this writer has a knack for pulling off the unknown and how things could be fun and interesting, and then eventually you realize you just stepped into something you shouldn't have stepped in, and suddenly you're having to figure out what's happening because things are going south. And that had a sense of that in this last episode, was a reminder of that, which was something we got in the first season as well. This moment of like, this isn't good. Like this, why is this character being put through this? This character shouldn't be put through this. And it doesn't fit the style at all. Like this has a very childlike style to it. And the characters look like they're straight out of, I don't know, children's books. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, things are getting really violent, and you don't know what's happening on the screen. It had that moment again with this recent episode, and I was going, oh gosh, we're doing this trap again. I'm feeling so unsettled. I'm feeling uncomfortable with what's happening on the screen. And then, yeah, it pulls it off so well. It's so great. I literally put in my thumbnail for the recent episode the biggest WTF moment, because I haven't had that feeling since. Obviously, I had that feeling with the movie. That movie sucked. I hate it and I love it at the same time. I hate that movie. But we had that same feeling with like certain moments of the first season as well. It's just, it's got a great cast of characters, a very interesting world, a world that is breathing. They pulled off, both the original creator and the animation team has pulled off, this is a breathing world that I want to see more of. I want to, just like Riko, I want to venture into it. And this is like adventure 101. Like, if you're a venture writer, and like any mangaka, any writer out there, if you're looking for like adventure 101, this writer knows it. And if you want to get some lessons, this guy pulls it off. And I love every minute of it. And I hate certain characters. They're making a Bondrood figure. Who the hell wants a Bondrood figure? Screw Bondrood. They're making a 1-1 scale Nanashi too, which I was like, I want that just so I can hug it. I want to hug that Nanashi figure.
I get the joke now.
What?
Never mind. Okay. I get the joke. It's something that happened on Discord and I didn't get it, and now I do.
So everybody on the that's listening to this podcast now knows Chris had a joke that he couldn't get, and now he's got it. So we're good. The only bad thing is we haven't seen Ozan in a while. I loved Ozan in the original series, and gosh dang, she was so great. Ozan's great. Ozan's like Bondrude, but I like her. But Bondrude's just irredeemable. It's never going to be redeemable. I'm never going to redeem Bondrude. No, it's super crazy. I cannot wait to find out where the connection is between the two storylines. They've kind of insinuated that we just met one of them. But I'm really interested to see how those two stories connect, because they've obviously set them up to connect somehow. They're both technically going to the same place. What signs are we going to get left behind from the other group, or if they're still there? Who knows?
But yeah. With this world, anything can...
Yep. Hollows. But anyways, super, super interesting. Really love it. Super crazy, intriguing, unsettling. It does everything perfectly. So that's Maiden Abyss, the golden city of the Scorching Sun. Definitely check out the series. It's great. So you have the opportunity. I think they have the first two movies. But yeah, if High Dive has the movies, you can watch just basically the first three movies, and you can get straight into the second season because they're technically recaps. So moving on, we have Dropkick on My Devil X. Yes, another season of Dropkick on My Devil is here. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 11 episodes, being done by Studio Nomad. The source is a web manga, and the genres are comedy, supernatural. Yes, this one has been quite... It's kind of like one of those weird, why does this keep getting seasons kind of shows? Like, I've always enjoyed Dropkick on My Devil, but at the same time, it's like, I know it's not like the most popular. It must be really huge in Japan, because apparently with this season, they actually kickstarted it, so they actually opened it up for crowdfunding, and people actually paid into getting another season of it, and that's really cool, because I've always kind of enjoyed this show. But essentially opens up with Yurine, and she's this girl that at some point does a summoning, which summons Joshin, this devil, and the whole joke early on was that Joshin wants to be freed from this, you know, summoning from Yurine, and the only way to do that is to kill Yurine, the one that summoned her. And the problem is that Yurine is like super strong for some reason. So everything Joshin tries to do, her signature drop kick on her, she always dodges it and then brutally murders Joshin. And Joshin's like got like super recovery. So every time that she cuts her in half or splits her left and right, she just recovers. Over the seasons, we've had a lot of introductions of different characters, including Medusa, who is Joshin's ATM. so Minotaur from the underworld as well. Then we have some characters coming from the heavens, like Pekore, who's a fallen angel, Pino, who's another fallen angel, and Poporon. And then some point learning about some ice queens. And then now with this season, we have the introduction of Liere, who is like the lord of all these angels that are fallen, that has come there to destroy it. And also Miku. I don't know where Hatsune Miku shows up in the show, so apparently there's some sort of collaboration happening between Dropkick on My Devil and Krypton, so Miku's like in every single episode, and I love it because we don't get a Hatsune Miku show ever, so to finally have Miku in something, I'm super happy. But she's kind of a side character that gets kind of pulled into different situations, so...
They stole leaks from Miku. I mean...
Didn't steal. She gave her 100 yen, which is more than value of what the thing is, so Miku was fine with it. Miku's like super pure, so she's just like, okay. Like, she gets kidnapped by the cop, and Miku's like, well, I gotta go now. Krypton lady's here. she's so passive. But yeah. Your thoughts on this season so far?
It's one of those things that I know that at some point it's gonna probably get better. It's one of those, with the sketch humor that is Dropkick on My Devil and or in other shows are similar, I know that they have the ability to be really, really funny, because there's been several times where it's been absolutely beyond bonkers, and I absolutely love it. So I'm trying to just be patient through the episodes that they're just trying to set up something that's probably going to be really funny later. But as it stands right now, the few episodes that I've seen of this, it hasn't really kind of been as funny as I'm used to for the show. So I'm just in this waiting period of knowing that at some point it's going to get really crazy funny.
I got a kick out of the whole change everybody. They want to refresh things and make it fresh for everybody. So they decided everybody wanted to like dress up as different art styles. So you had like the shonen character and the romance character. Everybody was taking on a different style just because Joshin was trying to be more serious because Joshin wanted a character change to be like the super serious character. And so everybody just kind of jumped on the train and just the goofiest character designs they decided to bring up, which was weird.
I like the Hanafuda battle per se. So yeah.
Now the thing that has always been Dropkick on My Devil is just like a bunch of bonker characters, some being like a lot more funnier than other ones, and just kind of seeing skits with those, that chemistry. Like it's always been that they set up the chemistry and that's what they play the jokes off of as it goes forward. It's got a really large cast of characters that all have different personalities.
Yeah.
But I will admit, yes, after I've always enjoyed Joshin Chan. Joshin Chan Dropkick, not Joshin. Joshin is kind of like the weakest character in the entire show, and she's always the main, always on the screen, which is kind of unfortunate.
She's the brunt of most of the slapstick.
Yeah, it's very violent slapstick humor, and it's mostly revolving around Joshin. But like overall, the entirety of the show has always been kind of a very meh comedy that I've always enjoyed. Like it's always been entertaining. I've always enjoyed the characters. I love the art style and the character designs. But overall, it's like it's a very meh comedy that I've always enjoyed. So it's one of those ones that's always difficult to sell people on as an entirety of its series. Cause this is like the third season, I think. Mm-hmm. That's the difficult part. I think the second season is still stuck on Amazon, if I remember correctly. So it's kind of all over the place if you wanted to catch up on it. It's not like you need to. I mean, the characters are very simple. Again, like I said, what I gave the character rundown earlier is literally it. You have the Fallen Angels. You have all these demons coming from the underworld. You have the Ice Queen, all that kind of stuff. That's the thing. There's no deep story here. So you could probably just jump right into this one, not be completely confused. You know, based on Minos having Minotaur horns, that's a Minotaur. So they're from the underworld. You know that Medusa is probably from the underworld as well because she's Medusa. It's simple concept and then insert jokes. I will say that I've enjoyed a couple of parts more than I did the second season. I was kind of dropping off for me, but I've enjoyed quite a bit so far this season, so it does feel like they're getting a little bit better with the writing. I think Lee Air is a nice little addition to the whole situation, and everybody being terrified that she's going to kill everybody even though she's not technically that strong is kind of funny. I've always got a kick out of the police officer lady. I know that Chris had a problem with her in the earlier segments, but I got a kick out of her segment was great, just gathering a bunch of cute things including Miku and then keeping them all hostage. Like, this is a police officer. She's supposed to be doing good things, but she's always doing bad things. This is always fun. So it's got a good cast. I really enjoy it. And it's never one that I go out of my way to tell people to watch unless they're just looking for a pretty basic comedy with a pretty cool cast of characters. So yeah, that's Dropkick on My Devil X. Check that out if that's interesting to you. Congratulations to them for getting another season, though. I'm kind of happy for that. Teppan is our next one. Teppan is being done by Studio Drive. Sources of manga. Genres are comedy, slice of life. This one's being directed by Shinji Takamatsu, who did Gintama and School Rumble. And series composition by Jun Kumagai, who did Shogun Roku Raku Shinju. So this one follows a group of comedic girls, Yayoi, Yomogi, and Yuzu. And they've pretty much... It's like, I don't know how much this backstory was actually true. Apparently, two of these girls had competed in a comedy routine thing a while back. They did pretty well. Jump forward in time, they meet each other again. They end up getting, going to this kind of preliminary contest for comedians. And they end up going to this one school where they take all these preliminary winners and train them to be, I think they're supposed to be training them to be comedians, but it's like trios, but basically they're comedy routine, a trio comedy routine. And in the school, there's a bunch of different groups of three girls that all train to be comedians, train their routines, and then go out and actually do competitions. So that's kind of what the setup was so far. I think like the first episode spent the entirety of the episode introducing us to like 20 different girls, which is, I think, my biggest issue that I'm having with the show so far. 20 different girls that are all in these different groups. I guess it wouldn't be 20 because it's groups of threes, but and then
it's 21.
The second episode, unfortunately, was not aired because, unfortunately, the assassination in Japan and the plot apparently was about assassination. We got the third episode, which was pretty much okay, following them going to this one. It's a little comedy show that this guy's obsessed with cute girls, so he doesn't do anything with them that's comedic because he likes cute girls and wants to put them in a gorgeous way. That's pretty much what I've gotten so far. It's just those two episodes. So have you watched it at all? Okay. Yeah, I will say this is a rough start for me, in true honesty. I think with that first episode, like I said, spending the entirety of the episode introducing a bunch of girls, I will say that it had a pretty fun punchline in the end, because it starts off with the girls doing a routine talking about, oh yeah, something terrible happened to somebody's treasured thing. And then it goes into explaining how this person that is essentially the dorm mother, he's like super muscular and he has this really cool trophy that he really treasures. And it kind of gets into explaining how that ended up getting broken, which was kind of a funny little punchline that they managed to build around developing how these characters met and everything, even though half the time it was just a joke how they were portraying it. This is what I mentioned earlier, that it's kind of, I don't know what's actually true and what's not true, but it had a fun little punchline that it had towards the end. And I was kind of wondering, okay, so in the following episodes, are I going to have that kind of creative writing with it? And I felt like that third episode didn't really do that. Like, it didn't have that good of a punchline in the end with it. It was just really around this guy that wanted to make this funny show, and or this cute show, and they wanted to be funny, but it's not working out. It had a couple fun little punchlines in that episode, but overall, it's not really doing it too much for me. It's like, it's a show about comedy routines, and it's not really that funny. I think a lot of people probably cut that up as it being just lost in translation. I don't necessarily think it is, because I don't necessarily see anything that's happening in there that shows me one thing while the translation's doing something different. Typically, I can kind of get some certain mannerisms and certain dialogue lines that match pretty well with the translation, and I'm not seeing anything that's going outside of that that leads me to believe that it's a translation issue. Everything's pretty basic with how it's laid out. Now, you could argue that it's because that's that style of comedy and it's not very Western style of comedy. I can agree with that. I have the same problem with Mangetsu, I think it was called. Mangetsu? The one that the Lucky Stars writer made. That one was kind of like going for they're bad at comedy. And when they did actually pull off a good comedy bit, which the characters responded to, it made sense to me why it was funny. This one is just kind of, they're obviously good at they're good enough at their art, and it's not that funny. It does have a fun nature to it, and the idea that these girls are standing there and they're talking about this experience they had, the other ones reacting to her blowing up something. Like, at some point, Yayoi's explaining in a way that makes Yomagi the one that was at fault for the breaking of the trophy. And so immediately Yomagi's like, you're trying to paint it out like it's my fault, and obviously it's not her fault. It has like a playfulness to the comedy that I do enjoy, so don't get me wrong. It's not like it's a complete lost cause, but I kind of wish that we had that second episode, despite the fact that it's a touchy subject right now, just because I wanted to have a little bit more experience as to what kind of comedy they have. But right now, from what I have, the episodes that I have available to me, it's not making me laugh a lot. The characters are fine. The interactions are fine. The chemistry's fine. There's too many characters, but I think they're doing well in kind of taking turns with each group and doing a story with them that will hopefully in the end not leave me with wanting more of each of the characters that they have too many of, which typically happens with, it sort of has that idol girl syndrome where you have this idol group of 12 plus characters and you're spending so little time with each one of them that you don't get enough out of them. So, but we'll see. That's my thoughts on Teppan so far. Nothing to write home about, but the chemistry is good. So that's enough. Black Summoner, Okuro no Shoukanshi. This one streamed on Crunchyroll. This done by Studio Satellite. The source is a light novel. The genres are action, adventure, fantasy. And this opens up with a guy named Kelvin. Well, he's eventually realizes his name's Kelvin. He wakes up in this other world, this fantasy world, and he has no memories of his past. Quickly, this goddess of reincarnation starts talking to him and explains to him that his prior self had him reincarnated with set skills. Like he said, she said that this previous self knew exactly what skills you'd want to take. He chose the perfect skills and sent him on his way. He also technically used his memories as collateral to buy extra skill points, so that's why he doesn't remember anything from his past. The goddess does inform him that he basically fell in love with this goddess. Like, he was infatuated by her and talked about how beautiful she was. And so she agreed that she was going to come with him and be reincarnated. She needed some time off from work anyway. So she's like, I'll be reincarnated with yourself. But of course, he doesn't have any memory. So he doesn't know, you know, why his previous self had a fascination with her. But yes, his skills that he chose are things like, you know, rapid growth, experience sharing, and yes, technically S-class summoner, which, come to find out over time, this goddess, Melfina, explains these certain things about the world, like being a summoner is extremely rare. There's like one to each country. They're often sought out. Most of them are like C rank in summoner, whereas he is an S rank. And what the S rank does is whatever he tames, he actually is able to give them like a bonus amount of points. So, you know, typically when you tame a level one, it's got like one or two to each stat. Well, he increases it like 100. So they have like starting out like way high stats, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, he's just kind of trying to level up, get stronger, goes to Adventure Guild, signs up the Adventure Guild, starts doing different things, gets his first tame, which is Cloth, and yeah, becomes overpowered very quickly. And then catch the attention of the guild, the Adventure Guild leader, who seemingly knows that he is not supposed to be of this world and that he's a tamer and wants to basically help him rise to the top. So, yeah, eventually he does get his second tame, which was like this armored knight dude that everybody was afraid of. He takes down a murderer at the same time, which is pretty much what gives him a lot of the attention from the guildmaster. So, yeah, and he really wants to level up so he can finally be able to have enough mana to summon Melfina, who's already like really high level because she's a goddess, so that he can figure out why his previous self was so infatuated by Melfina. Also, he bought a girl, an elf girl from a slave trader. So that's apparently a thing this season, is buying girls. Seems to be a quirk. Every season has that one thing. Like, why is there suddenly a bunch of shows about this? So your thoughts on Black Summoner so far?
I'm pretty interested in the show. I do like a lot of the characters. I think that the interplay between the characters and what's going on around him is kind of interesting. I kind of want to dig into this world a bit more. I think that it's been fairly surface level so far, as far as what is kind of the, what is the thing that they're trying to do here? As it stands right now, I I'm completely fine with this because the one that has been deemed the Chris show is doing something similar in the fact that it's trying to put out a character in this world and just live out his life, and it seems like that's what they're kind of trying to do here. And that's the, I guess what I'm trying to see here is, are they trying to go for more of a slice of life-ish feel? Or if they're trying to build something more grander?
His harem, obviously, because everybody's assuming he's building a harem. Oh, you have an elf girl now. She's part of the harem, right? Oh, now you have this person. Now that's part of the harem, right? Oh, the adventure guild lady at the counter. She's obviously part of your harem.
The one,
right?
Who owns the inn. Oh, no. She's not a part of his harem.
Oh, yeah, definitely her.
And that's the, I do like the concept of it. And I like the idea of just a general, kind of an isekai setting and then turning it into a slice of life. And that, I'm completely fine with that. I don't see any weight to offset his OP-ness. And that's the thing that kind of bugs me, is I like it. However, I think that he is a bit too overpowered and he's not, it's not giving you kind of some kind of a struggle for whatever it is that he's doing. Having just an OP character is fine in itself as long as you have something that kind of offsets that. And right now, I don't see that. He's just overpowered for the sake of being overpowered. And, oh, by the way, let's gather up the girls. So I want to kind of put that out there as an offset to, yeah, I generally am enjoying it. I'm fine with just goofy antics of a character, just living life and enjoying life.
Yeah, I think the only limit they were putting on him is more the idea that he was trying to keep it a secret, and that's pretty much gone now.
Mm-hmm.
And as for the expansion of the world, technically the guild leader guide pretty much points out most of what it seemed like they're doing is this idea that, oh yeah, by the way, there's other isekais, and oh, by the way, they're heroes too. But at the same time, Melfina the entire time going, but don't worry about them. It's like, just don't worry about them. It's like, yeah, you're obviously going to get into them eventually, but right now it seems like they don't want to get into that whole situation. It's like, this is what we're kind of putting in play. We'll probably get into it later. Probably conflict between nations, and the heroes will be from another nation kind of thing. But yeah, so far it's been just pretty much laid back, have fun in the world. It really does feel like the focus of this writer is just the idea of Kelvin enjoying his new life. I didn't realize it until I watched the recent episode that it reminded me that something was in the synopsis that I'd completely forgotten about, which is that Kelvin likes battle, and it seems like that nature is coming back to him. Is this idea that when he was fighting this big knight, you could see how much he was enjoying his fight. And it was the same thing when he was fighting the murderers. Like, you just see how twisted he suddenly becomes. He really enjoys fighting. And so I'm sure that'll probably be an aspect of him, that he just enjoys battle so much. I'm not sure if it's going to get to a thing where he gets so into battling that he just fights for the sake of fighting, which could turn into something interesting. I doubt it. But at the same time, so far, it's laid out a very laid back, here's your new life. You've been given all the things that you need from your previous self, and go enjoy it. And oh, by the way, here's this hanging fruit, which is, let's get strong enough to summon Nelfina so that we can figure out why my previous self loved her so much. But other than that, it's been fine. I will say the CGI battle with the Dark Knight came out of nowhere and it was very off-putting. Which sucked, because like the first episode was fine with the fact of how unanimated it was, but they did enough that it worked, and I was fine with it. And then we get into the fight with the knight, and suddenly it's like, boom, it looked like we're suddenly watching like a CGI fighting game, and like, wait, stop doing this. It doesn't look good. Stop doing this. But it wasn't terrible at the same time. But yeah, I'm kind of on the same page. I just think it's fine. It's not doing anything incredible. I would say that I felt like the whole introduction of the elf was a little weird, because they went out of their way to explain that she's never had a master. She's been, she was sold off ever since she was young enough to remember, when she was a child. She doesn't know where her parents at. And it's like, okay, so then how does she know how to walk, and how does she know how to cook, and all this stuff doesn't really add up to, has she been in a cage for, I mean, I don't even know how old she is. She's probably 200 years old. Has she been in a cage ever since she was, you know, young? And so now she's been in a cage for 200 years? Like, it doesn't, none of this adds up. The fact that you're saying that she's always been, this has always been her life, yet she's never had a master, and yet she's probably a 200-year-old elf. None of this stuff seems to be adding up to it making any sense. And her quick change to accepting her new life, again, I guess I don't expect them to get deep into the fact that she's never had a free life now, and now she suddenly technically sort of has a free life. The transition didn't work right, and they didn't do well enough to really hit on the idea that, yes, technically she's been in a cage her whole life, and now finally she's able to, you know, sit at a table and eat a meal. It seemed like a missed opportunity, but again, I assume that that's because this writer doesn't really want to get deep like that. Just wants to have fun. Oh, now he's got a girl. There you go. That's all they're really trying to do. Don't try to think too much on it. Yeah, it's fine. It's fine so far.
And when it comes down to it, out of the two, I like this one better, honestly. So
out of the two, this and Harem and Labyrinth and Another World?
No.
You like this more than Harem and Labyrinth and Another World?
No, that one, I not even... The Isekai Summoner, whatever.
Uncle Another World? I like Uncle Another World.
Yeah, I wasn't including that. I was talking this one and Isekai Life or whatever. The one.
Oh, yeah, my Isekai Life. The not reincarnated as a slime. Yeah, that one's pretty bad. But we'll get into that later. We'll get into that one later. Yeah, there you go. If you want to just have a fun, don't think about things too much show about a guy that just enjoys combat and has cool little quirks to his skills, there you go. That's Black Summoner. Moving on, we have Shinepost. This one is streaming on HiDive. It's being done by Studio Kai. The source is light novel and a multimedia project. Genres are music. Director is Kei Oikawa, who's done Art Club Has a Problem, Minami Kei, Outbreak Company, and Snafu. And the original creator is Rakuda, who is, of course, known for creating Orisuki. So And this one opens up following a group of idols from the group Tings. And it's Haru, Ryo, and Kyoka. And the three of them, one day, kind of shows how Haru was, you know, just going to work. And she's enjoying the fact that everything seems to be going her way. She's getting a ton of free popsicles. All the crosswalk signs going her direction. She thinks it's going to be a great day. And then she gets called to the manager, the owner's office, where the owner says, yeah, I'm thinking about disbanding y'all. And they're just, like, devastated. But she's like, you know, I'm thinking of it. I'm going to let you guys have one more opportunity. I have this venue. I want you guys to fill it up. And if you don't fill it up, well, I'm going to have to disband you guys, unfortunately. But I'm going to help you guys by getting you a designated manager, which is this guy named Naoki Hinase. And the quirk that we find out from Naoki is that he's able to see people that shine. And so when he kind of goes there, he quickly goes, look, I got hired here, but I got hired here to work here. I'm not going to be a manager. I'm done being an idol manager. I'm just going to work at this company, do my thing. And so, yeah, the three girls are kind of pushed by the owner to have to convince him to being their manager, which turns this whole thing of them begging him. And eventually he lets them kind of perform a little bit, do a little practice dance. He realizes, man, these girls are really rough, but I'm not sure yet. And then he asks them kind of the typical idol question, which is, what do you do? What do you do? Each one of them answers. And then eventually he goes, all right, I'll do it. We'll do it. I'm gonna give you a preliminary. We're gonna do one venue, and we'll see if you guys can fill that out. If you can, we'll see from there. And we kind of found out shortly later from his conversation with the owners that he can see people that shine when they lie. And Haru, the center, didn't shine when she said what makes her an idol, what drives her. And so she's technically a genuine idol, and that's what caught his interest. So he kind of helps them out. They sell some tickets. He kind of uses his connections to get the place sold out. And eventually they have their first performance with him as a manager, where a bunch of people that they kind of ended up getting into this venue, which are people that are, you know, they're knowledgeable about idols. They have a more critical eye. It kind of shows how they all realize that Haru is kind of special, and the idea that she can grab the audience, and additionally, she's a genuine idol, and people love supporting genuine idols. So, yeah, your thoughts on Shine Post?
It was actually interesting. Andrew kind of popped up and asked me how I felt about this show, and I was actually surprised that we were kind of generally in at least in line on how much this one is actually quite the surprise. One of the things that Andrew was mentioning that I think that I kind of caught me was in particular Naoki trying to find out if the girls were what the girls wanted to be idols for. And interestingly enough, at one point during the starting kind of build up to this scene, at some point Naoki brings up the fact that he wanted to be the manager of idols and get them seen by the entire world. That's where the name Shine Post comes from. And because in Haru's version of the same thing, meaning that both of these characters are actually their motivations are in line. He says it in a slightly different way than she does, but in particular, she points out that she wants to be a shine post for the entire world. She wants the world to see idols. And this is something that Naoki says at some point as well, that he wants to support idols and get them to the point where the entire world sees them. And I love that this is.
And he got fired for it because he did it too well. that was like the only thing that I hated was like this whole backstory of him like being really good at his job, and he gets all the jobs, and then eventually it shows him like overhear another employee who was kind of hanging out with him at some point being mad because not liking him because he does so well, he gets all the work, and then he eventually shows him with the owner of the company going like, I'm sorry, but I have to leave, and he's like, yeah, this is kind of causing problems. I'm like, no, the manager would be like, fire that lady because yeah, you're doing a good job. Like, what owner, what, what boss is this? It's like the worst boss ever to fire the guy that's doing a good job. But anyways,
but yeah, that alignment of those two characters kind of added this interesting perspective of characters who their motivations, as long as motivations are aligned, can become basically power teams. And I like that, that this is kind of being portrayed. And the tidbit about the Shining, as to
Shining.
The Shining,
talking scissors,
Shining, these characters, and whether or not they're lying or not is an interesting tidbit that I misunderstood it completely, but I still came in the same direction as Andrew was pointing out when we were talking about this. I love the fact that towards the end of the last episode, we were watching these characters as they were building up, and they got on the stage, and they were filled up, and the characters were talking behind the crowd, and I walked away from that episode very interested in this aspect of Haru is effectively kind of downplaying herself to bring up the other two girls. Not saying that the other two girls were bad, just that she was compensating for them to make them make the team as itself look good. And the shift of perspective that Naoki was giving Haru is stop looking at your partners and look at the crowd. And that would be an interesting tidbit of, instead of overcompensating for the other two, make the other two overcompensate to bring themselves to your level. And I think that that'll be an interesting aspect as well. All in all, that my point being is that there's a lot going on in this show that I was impressed that this stuff was actually coming out of this show for something that would be effectively Idolmaster kind of knockoff. This actually is working really well, and I'm really enjoying the attention to detail of these characters that is coming out of it.
Well, I think I kind of equate it to something like Idol Deep Pride, where it seems like the manager's a lot more involved with the storytelling than typically with these idol shows. Typically, it's the girls. The girls do this, they have their backstory moment, we get to hear their backstory, and then have great performance at the end. This one seems like it's a lot more involved with the manager. It's doing a nice... I would argue that it's more balanced to the manager so far, and I'm sure going forward we're going to get more of the other ones, because we've already seen a little bit into Rio as a character and the idea that she seems like she's outside of the group. It seems like she doesn't have as many fans as the other two do. When they had this, a bunch of fans suddenly showed up. One came to Rio, and it seems like really quickly she didn't have anybody else to really talk to, and then she got mad and left. Then she comes back, but we didn't really see resolve there. And I think that we're going to eventually get into that. We're going to see what is Rio's insecurity. Obviously, again, I think that she just doesn't have as many fans as the other two have. The idea of how unsuccessful they are is a thing, and I do like that they're willing to show that these girls are disappointed that they only have like five people there. They're diehard fans that are there, but they're still disappointed because they want to shine more. And I do like that they're willing to do that. I think the three girls have a great chemistry. I've already mentioned before several times in some other videos, I'm not looking forward to Yukine and Momiji getting involved, because it obviously shows the key art that they're going to get involved. Because I think they're conflicted with the chemistry that I'm already establishing with Haru, Ryo, and Kyoka. They have a great chemistry. They have a fun little nature to themselves. Haru and Ryo kind of bounce off each other in trying to dive into situations. Kyoka's almost always like that very quiet to herself type of girl, but she's always the one that comes out to do the punchlines. It's got a good chemistry so far. Ryo's got the whole superiority complex thing going on with her character that she's doing. Haru is more kind of, again, more ganky and just more pure nature. Kyoka, again, being more to herself, a little bit more quiet, but at the same time being the one that wants to throw in the pranks. It's got a good chemistry, and I've been enjoying the character so far. And I've always enjoyed a smaller cast of characters when it comes to idol shows, so I technically don't want it to get into a lot of characters. But so far, the setup has been really solid. Visually, Studio Kai, thank you. The show looks great. Like, visually, it looks fantastic. The character designs are great. It's got a much more lush look to the characters themselves. Yes, I've joked before, and I'll joke again, transparent t-shirt fetish this creator seems to have. So, for some reason, all you have to see underneath their white t-shirts all the time, what they have underneath it. They're not showing anything. They're just showing, like, their undershirts or their sports bra, whatever they're wearing. But yeah, that was kind of a fun thing to kind of note. But the performances are drawn. Like, they actually draw the performance. Yes, you can see some CGI usage. It's mainly from way far away shots, but whenever it's close up, you get to see the characters. And this is where I want to hit on my biggest point to make on this show, as opposed to any other idol show, is the fact that they're willing to draw those animation and animate those characters performing. I could see how those characters acted. I mentioned it, the idea that in the later part of the second episode, getting into Naoki mentioning the four unique things about this group. The first, Ryo, is a go-getter. She puts a lot of effort into her stuff. Kyoka, she's a perfectionist, or at least she's very polished. Her performance is always very polished. Haru, she knows how to pay attention. She's very observant and she reacts, which went to the whole point of when they practiced, Haru was looking at the two other girls and getting in the middle point. So if one strayed too far right, she'll lean a little bit more to the right so that they balance. And what he wanted her to do was to observe the audience and perform to them instead, which made her kind of shine more. And they didn't get into the fourth one, but my assumption is that people seen that she's genuine, which is the whole point they were making at with the whole shining aspect. So what was great about the fact that they animated these characters, I can see that. I see Ryo pushing herself. I see Kyoka being very refined. And yes, I seen Haru looking at the other two girls in their practice, which shows me that you can see just when they actually animate and animate in those expressions and animate in those gestures, it tells a different story. And I'm so happy that they're willing to actually. Now, they could totally, from this point on, go full CGI. Like I said, they're technically dabbling in it. But for now, it looks incredible. I will say the music so far is not really catching me. I did love Hotaru, who was the performer from the very first episode. I love that song. It was really good. But so far, the music's not really grabbing me. But it's good. It's fine music. I'm enjoying it. But everything else is great. Again, the setup's great. It's got a quirk in there. I'm sure eventually we're going to get into probably him trying to get Ryo and Kyoka to finally not shine. That way they're genuine. But for now, we have Haru. She is pretty much the shining beacon of the show itself in her true nature. So really enjoying it. I think the setup for that second episode really did sell me on the show. I love that they have these other two idols in the back going, you're kind of mean bringing in all these people that know idols. And because now you're just setting them up to be criticized by all these people that are just connoisseurs of idols. And then their manager's like, yeah, you don't know. He knows exactly what he's doing. These people know Haru is genuine. They know what they're doing. So it was a really cool way to end the second episode. And this is the question mark. And I probably should have left this for the next podcast episode. I'm really curious what now. Like, we've got the setup, we've built it up, we've hit the punchline for the opening. What now? And I'm hoping it does well, but we'll have to wait and see. Because technically, I don't like Orisuki. So I didn't like Orisuki that much. So we'll see. We'll see. Maybe they do better with idols, but we'll see. But yeah, that's Shinepost. Definitely a huge surprise for me this season. Definitely one of my favorites of the season so far. Definitely for the new ones. So yeah. Harem in the Labyrinth of Another World, or as we call it on the Discord, Chris's show. Isekai Mikyo de Harem Wo. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll, unfortunately. Not sure how many episodes it's running for. Being done by Studio Passione. The source is a light novel. The genres are action, adventure, fantasy, ecchi, romance. Director is Naoyuki Tatsuya, who did Nisekoi. So yeah, this one opens up with Michio. It's this guy that was browsing the web. Totally nothing bad happening in his previous life. He was just browsing the web. Totally not considering something really terrible. He was just browsing the web. And he eventually clicks to sign up for some random game that he misses the prompt that tells him, hey, you can't turn back. Once you click OK, you're literally going to be involved with this. And sure enough, it transports him into another world. He's given some kind of starter weapons and stuff. He's in some random village. It gets attacked by bandits. He takes down the bandits. Realizes that he has this unique ability to see stats of people and items. Later on, discovering that he can actually change his own job and change the stats on weapons. Eventually, he helps with the bandits. Turns in the bandits for a reward. Where he ends up discovering this forced servitude person that wants to offer Michio this wonderful Roxanne. This Roxanne that is perfect for a starter, for servitude. I'm saying for servitude for a reason because it's YouTube. For servitude lady that is willing and she's pure and she's really hot. So, yeah, but it's very expensive. So he gives Michio, 5 days to raise up the money in order to buy her. So he sits out on the labyrinths, learns about his unique skills, his jobs, eventually realizing he's not going to be able to raise the money fast enough. So he decides that he's going to go the more risky route, but more profitable route, which is to take out bandits. So he does that and eventually wins the game. He acquires Roxanne. What's your thoughts?
As it stands right now, I'm of two minds. I absolutely love this story. I was super excited about it when it was coming, and I'm loving a lot of what's going on here. My only tidbit of frustration, and this is probably just kind of an aspect of being normal. Everybody goes through this when they watch something that they really love, that was originally a light novel or a manga or whatever have you. I'm going through the same issue of, holy crap, why did they leave a lot of this
so
stuff?
So much better.
I think that in a lot of ways, and this is probably where I'm giving a lot of credit where credit is due. I think that they're streamlining in a lot of ways. Where I'm concerned is what has been streamlined out is one of the things that kind of is a little bit Andrew had mentioned in one of his videos that I had pointed out, I don't like the fact that they kind of just left the character reset aspect off to the side, because this is one of the things that's kind of really kind of core to Michio's, for lack of a better term. I'm going to get in trouble today. That's Michio's OP power, is his ability to kind of reset his bonuses. On the Discord, somebody had mentioned skills. This is not really a skill thing per se as bonuses. And using that character reset is kind of his ability to shift his power aspect. So that is, in effect, his overpoweredness. And so I really do like what they're doing, because I absolutely enjoy seeing a lot of these characters that have been in my head for a long time, actually moving, getting stuff going and actually finally seeing the anime version of this. And as we have finally received, or we have finally acquired Roxanne, now we're going into the next part, and the what you really truly see this story and for what it is after Sherry, which is the next
spoiler
party member. The interesting aspect is that's when you will really see where the story kind of works. All this getting up to that point is really setting up these characters and how their personal. I'm talking way too much about.
You're talking
this.
Way too much about what's not in the show. That's the problem with this, like reading the source material. It's like, hey guys, so about this anime, yeah, what it's not doing that the other thing did, and what it's going to do in the future is this, and it's like, you're not talking about the show.
Shut up.
Jeez, Siri.
The reason why I even talked about all this crap is I want to see where they. If the streamlining is going to continue at the rate that they're going, or if they're going to actually start really playing the story. And that's what I'm very curious of, is if they're going to keep continuing to cut, because that's going to tell me really ultimately how much is going to get cut comparative to if they've gotten all the, I'm done cutting stuff that doesn't need to be cut. Now we're going to get into the real story is really what I'm curious of.
So yeah, this anime, not the light novel. I'm enjoying it so far. I'm actually surprisingly enjoying it. I will say there's certain aspects of it that I think I'm overthinking as I'm watching each episode, but even still, I've been enjoying it, because it's kind of one of those ones that does technically hit on some heavy subjects while at the same time not apologizing for it, while at the same time giving you the vantage point of the lesser of evils. As I kind of mentioned before, it's one of those ones that you can't technically, you can't really defend it, but at the same time, you can see that it's not as bad as it could be. What they're kind of establishing here is that Michio has transported this world. He does technically have a unique gimmick about himself that does make him somewhat overpowered, at least from the vantage point of an anime viewer. And he's given this opportunity to essentially build a party through the perspective of cute girls, which is, again, this seller of forced servitude. And he technically really quickly gets really obsessed with his first buy, which is Roxanne. Like, he's going way out of his way. Like, this is his driving force, his living and breathing in this new world that he's not really kind of addressing too much about, is to get this girl, to get her a part of his party. And it kind of lays out in a way early on as the idea of, well, if I don't buy her, somebody else will. So why not? Again, that lesser evil thing, which is the attitude that this thing exists in this world. He can't change it. He's not going to suddenly yell, close this building down. This is inappropriate to have. No, he's just like, okay, this is happening in this world, and somebody else can have her, or I can have her. So I'm gonna make sure that I get her. And again, it doesn't apologize for it, but at the same time, it technically applies in the world, and that goes in the realm of the bandits and taking them down. He acknowledges, if I don't kill these dudes, somebody else will. They exist here. There's no police officers to call and say, hey, they're over here, go take them down. No, if I don't do it, somebody else will, and if I don't, they'll continue to do what they're doing. So, again, lesser of evils in this world, and it accepts it. I do technically appreciate that. I like the fact that they've done pretty well so far in addressing his, I guess, realizing, or at least being affected by what he's dealing with. It's an obviously a gamey world, but he still does have issues with the idea of, well, I just killed a bunch of people, and he feels sick about it. And then having it happen again, him realizing, oh, it's not my mana depletion, it's because I just did something really terrible. I just cut off a bunch of heads. It was kind of unsettling how they kind of portrayed some of that stuff, because when it does come to him killing bandits, his knife cuts through like butter, and it's kind of unsettling how it plays it out. And then him realizing, like I said, whenever he depletes his mana, he gets very depressed. So it shows him like use teleport a bunch, and then he realizes like, what am I even doing this for? Like, he starts getting really down on himself, and then he realizes, oh, this is because I'm depleted in mana. It makes me feel like I want to give up on things. And so it played a little bit into that with him killing the bandits. He thought that, but it's not really the case. He is reflecting on that he did a terrible thing. So I appreciate that they were willing to do that, even though he kind of gets over it pretty quickly. But I kind of like it so far in that regard. I feel like a lot of the, like, kind of Chris was hitting on with the idea of what's not in the show that's in the show. I do agree that really quickly when it jumps into him swapping skills around and stats around in his weapons, it doesn't explain any of it. It's like he just suddenly cuts to him going, I got to prepare, brings up his weapon, and suddenly he's moving stuff around, and then he just makes it disappear. And I'm like, I have no clue what he just did. I don't know if I care. Like, I don't know that I care to have it do like a big information dump. I'm kind of figuring out as it goes along. So maybe that's to their credit, is that I don't really necessarily need it explained to me. But yeah, just kind of just changing jobs, changing stats. That's his gimmick. And I'm kind of curious when it finally gets around to, now that he owns technically Roxanne, will he be able to apply that stat stuff and that stat changing stuff to her like he was able to do with the items? But I'm sure we'll figure that out as it goes along. I'm curious what he's going to do next. I mean, he's obviously technically gotten his girl. Now it's going to go move into, okay, does he, you know, do they hit the sack, or is it going to go into straight into, let's go into the labyrinth and let's start killing more stuff? I was half expecting the moment that he got Roxanne that it was going to be like, okay, well, thanks, Michio, for your purchase. Now, hey, next girl, come on in. Because it really does feel, and again, this is me probably overthinking things, it really does feel like Alan, like, at least sees something in Michio that he wants to entrust. Because, I mean, Roxanne was kind of portrayed as, like, this gem. Like, he goes to the Red Light District, and he's like, none of these girls are anywhere near Roxanne. I'm kind of glad I didn't go into those rooms. It kind of plays it out like Roxanne is a special thing that is obviously a fighter slash pure slash willing slash all this stuff, and thick. As the anime portrays, very, very thick. So, yeah, I'm interested to see the other girls. They did kind of show a little bit of his seemingly entire harem in this kind of flash forward, which was kind of unsettling and maybe didn't like Michio. But it's like he just walks up and, hey, this kid's got black hair. Yeah, it's probably me. Peace out, kid. I'm like, whoa, what a dirtbag. Don't really like you right now, Michio. You're kind of a dirtbag. But yeah, we'll see where it goes from here. It's enjoyable. It's definitely not doing anything that is throwing me off. It's got enough drama when it needs drama. And yes, don't watch the Crunchyroll version. Because Crunchyroll, yes, to shock to nobody, got the fully censored version, even though they're technically on, like, the board. Like, they are part of the committee. And they somehow didn't manage to get the uncensored version. I don't even know why they were on the
committee. I was thinking the same thing. Why the heck are they on the...
Why are you even paying into this thing? It doesn't make any sense. You know this is going to be the quote-unquote controversial one. That must have been Funimation's decision. Like, because I think the guy that... I don't know. They probably had the Crunchyroll... The guy that's still there from Crunchyroll. But if the guy from Funimation took over and was a part of that decision, that's that interspecies reviewer thing all over again. Why? Anyways, yeah, that's Harriman Labyrinth of Another World. If you are a degenerate and are not easily offended, check it out. If you're easily offended, don't watch it. It's nothing against you. Just don't watch it. It's not going to be your bread and butter. Yeah. And it seems like people love watching my impressions video on it. Maybe it's because they're thirsty or they just want to hear somebody talk about a controversial show. Who knows?
I think a lot of it is people that are really wanting to see people converted. And I think that I'm actually very impressed how much it's honestly converting people in itself. Is I know there's something there for people to enjoy if they'll get past what a lot of people just don't want to get past.
There we go. When will Ayumu make his move? Or Soredemo Ayumu wa Yoshitakuru. This one is streaming on High Dive, running for an unknown amount of episodes. I don't have it yet. Silver Link is the studio working on it. Sources and manga. Genres are comedy, romance, slice of life. I'm going to assume it's probably 12 episodes. Director is Mirai Minato, who did Jahe-sama Will Not Be Defeated, Fate Collide, Liner Prisma, Masamune-kun's Revenge. Creator is Soichiro Yamamoto, who's, of course, known for doing Teasing Master Takagi-san, as well as In the Heart of Konichi Sabaki, so Forehead Girls. Series composition by Hitomi Mueno, who, of course, has done a lot of stuff, including Snow White with Red Hair and Flying Witch, which we mentioned earlier, doing two shows. But yeah, this one follows Ayumu and Urushi. And Ayumu has recently quit his kendo. He's always done kendo his entire life. He's quit his club to join the Shogi Club, which is not technically a club so far. They still need more members, but there is a room that is licensed as the club that he goes to. And he wants to go there because he wants to hang out with Urushi, which is his senpai, who is the leader of the not yet solidified Shogi Club. And he's very straightforward. Very forward with her, says that she's really cute, really likes being around her, loves seeing her smile, all this stuff. Like, he says everything in the book about how much he likes Urushi, but he has not yet confessed that he loves her. And Urushi realizes this and is wondering why he doesn't admit it. She even says, like, you got to have a thing for me, don't you? And he never admits it because Ayumu has made, like, a restriction upon himself that he will not confess to her until he beats her in shogi, which sucks because Urushi is really good at shogi. So it's kind of just the shenanigans between the two of them. Urushi trying to get Ayumu to confess, Ayumu being very forward, throwing her off quite a bit because of how forward he is, how very straight-faced he is. And over time, we get to meet some other characters, including Sakurako and Takaru, who Takaru used to do kendo with Ayumu. He's quit kendo also to hang out at the library with Sakurako. Their whole thing is that she can... He's very easily susceptible to hypnosis, and so she does that a lot to force him to do stuff. I'm just waiting for her to hit. I was expecting this recent episode for her to hypnotize and say who she likes, but they're cute. Maki, who is a friend of Urushi, who just knows something's going on between the two of them, so she's constantly just kind of pushing Urushi and Ayumu at each other. So, yeah, that's pretty much the whole deal. What are your thoughts on it?
I believe I'm an episode behind, but... I absolutely love this show.
You missed the Dato episode where Sakurako probably. And Takaru were hiding in the grave.
Yes. Aww. I did not see any of that.
That was cute.
But yeah, I've absolutely loved what I have seen of it so far. It's one of those just it's very different flavor than Teasing Master Takagi-san. However, it still works really well for what it's doing. I mean, Ayumu as this kind of not necessarily teasing Urushi, but in a way it's kind of that flavor, but in a different way. And so it works really well because in a lot of ways, Urushi is the one that's actually on the receiving end of his forwardness. Yeah.
I like when he actually gets hit by it. He always just kind of does the thing where he puts his hand on his face and tilts his head back. And she's always like, are you okay? And he's like, That was just really cute. I was like, yep, that's me. Like, when she first held up that one, the paw, and it said Ayuma, and she's like, I really love Ayuma, too. And then it's like, oh, crap. And then he just does that whole thing, like, oh, that was so cute.
It really works for their chemistry. I really like the cast that they've got going on. Like Andrew had mentioned, the hypnotizing Takeru to go and do something for her, and it's like, I can't wait to see what they do with these characters. But yeah, it's been a absolutely fantastic time. I've enjoyed a lot of it. Go watch it for sure.
Yeah. I think this is definitely in the same vein as something like TZ Master Takagi-san, which I kind of mentioned, and it's the idea that take TZ Master Takagi-san, grow them up a little bit to where you do have, unlike with TZ Master Takagi-san, where, you know, the boy is kind of, he's very immature. He doesn't understand what love is, and thus he thinks that he's just being teased. This one, Ayumu, understands what's in front of him. He's going after it. He just can't confess quite yet. And so you do have that aspect that even though Urushi is trying to tease Ayumu, he always fires it back at her. Which technically happened a little bit in TZ Master Kage-san. Every now and then, Nishikata would fire back with something, but it was always like he never realized that he was firing back. And that would throw off Takagi. So this is very different in the idea that it's a lot more mature. The relationship's kind of established right off the bat. Like, these two know we like each other. It's just, the confession's not quite there yet. They're going on dates. They're doing all these things together. They're already going on a relationship. It's just, you know, it's that push back and forth that's happening. And yes, technically, a majority of this show is just Urushi's face. Like, her reacting every 2 seconds to everything is kind of the show. Now, I will admit in that regard, that's kind of the shtick. It's just a cute show. Let's see Urushi's faces. That's really the most of it. It's just kind of seeing a cute, established relationship, have fun little moments together, discovering things together. Again, technically with this recent episode, it's all about the both of them discovering what it's like to do a date. Like, they don't know. Even though one wants to act like they know, they don't know. I will say that with this one, they are doing a lot better with the side characters. Technically with TZ Master Kage-san, they had a side couple. And I loved watching them as well. This one's kind of keeping very focused, the side characters so far, with Sakurako and Takeru and Maki. So I'll definitely be interested to see what they do with the characters going forward. But so far, it's been very cute, very laid back, very, I won't say simple. It's complicated enough as how they're laying out each scenario, with something being laid out, Ayumu throwing Urushi off, or Urushi doing something that she doesn't realize she's doing just to throw off Ayumu. It's really the case too. I always love whenever Ayumu kind of suggests something and Urushi like reluctantly accepts it. Then he does that whole thing where she's blushing, looking off the direction, and he's over there like doing the whole yes thing. I think Ayumu is cool. So yeah, definitely looking forward to more. It's a lot of fun. Really enjoy it. When will Ayumu make his move? Moving on, we have a Smile of the Ars Notoria, the animation, or Wararu Ars Notoria Sun. This one's being done by Leiden Films, streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 12 episodes. The source is a mobile game. Character designs by Shinichiro Utsuka, who did, obviously, Conception, ReZero, Granbelm. Very unique style to them. And director is Naoyuki Tatsuwa, who did Nisekoi. So, I don't even know where to start. There's this place that's kind of referred to as the garden, where these girls are there. They're all mages known as flowers who are training in magic and being pretty girls and refined girls. They just hang out, drink tea. They check wards on a regular basis, look for bugs, because if bugs show up, they could bring catastrophe as well. We're assuming the catastrophe is these brief little clips of this other world that's more like a straight medieval world where these pretty boys show up and kill people. I don't know. I think that's what's going on. Cute girls doing cute things, and every now and then brief shots of pretty boys massacring people, because that's obviously a good contrast. Your thoughts?
Andrew's list of characters, Ars Notoria, Aberleem, and then goes through all of the girls, and then at the end, bunch of mean pretty boys.
Pretty much. I didn't want to put them all up there, because they're just all doing the same thing. They have different voices, though. I think one was Kendra Suda, wasn't it? I think one's Kendra
Suda. Yeah, I think so.
That sucks.
And I think Ushio was in there somewhere.
Pretty boys with good voice actors.
Andrew came and asked me what this show was, and I honestly, I have no answer. I really, what it comes down to is this show is freaking gorgeous characters, and they're doing stuff. And that's it. I mean, they spent an entire...
Our Satoria lost her sniffing ability.
Oh, no.
Because, like, in the very beginning, she's like, we established very quickly that our Satoria likes to sniff, sniff, sniff. And every 2 seconds, her dialogue is sniff, sniff, sniff. Because her sniffing is apparently very strong. So she's able to smell anything from a distance. And we had an entire episode of her sniffer breaking. And so she had to fix her sniffer. And the cat shows up very quickly and explains how to fix her sniffer. She just doesn't realize what she's was talking about. So they decide to bring a bunch of stinky stuff for her to sniff. So she sniffs, sniffs, sniffs. And then eventually they have a pillow party. And then she sniffs one girl, the blanket that's on one girl. So I'm not sure if she's sniffing part of her or sniffing the sheets. But she sniffs and her sniffer starts working again. So soon, soon, soon. Yes, that's... Anyway, sorry, Cody. Did you miss that episode?
No, I haven't seen that.
That was some massive character development. Not really, but yeah.
the thing is I absolutely... I mean, it's cute girls doing cute things and...
With bloody massacres happening on the side.
Yeah, that's the one thing that's kind of... I don't know if I want that. But at the same time, when it comes down to it, I have to agree with Andrew. I don't really know what it is.
Like, are we trying to establish, like, these cute girls are super cute and we fall in love with them over like five episodes and then suddenly out of nowhere the pretty boys make it to the garden and start massacring people? I mean, do we think we're going there? I don't think so, because it's a mobile game and you have waifus. Waifus can't be killed in mobile games. So I don't think they're going to get killed, but obviously they're killing a lot of people in the other world. Ugly people, obviously, because old people, old ladies, no cute girls are massacred in the other world.
Yeah.
All the cute girls are in the garden.
Obviously.
The flowers have to be in the garden.
But anyway, as it stands right now, it's got cute girls, and I enjoy watching them do cute things.
Theory. Obviously, everything's like very symbolic here. What do you think about the whole blurry figure that obviously looks like it's changing into a male and a female? Do you think it's where some males do come to the garden, but they have to be disguised as females? Because we did see, like, most of the time they just showed, like, these blurry looking wobbly figures that would walk by and they would bow to them, but they would never respond to them. But then we had one, and it was always like a female figure. But then we had one moment where she's in there where our Satoria is talking to Solo, the leader, and she's talking about how, like, bugs must be squished. I love that scene. Bugs must be squished. But then this figure walked in, like, just randomly walks in, like, just not even invited in, just walks in and stops. And our Satoria, like, you know, excuses herself for a very brief shot. It flickered from a female-looking form that was shorter with longer hair to a taller form with shorter hair, which looked obviously like a male. So I'm wondering if males can come there. They just have to be disguised as females because they don't want the girls to be around males. But there are some males that are good. Like, not all males are pretty boys slaughtering people in another world.
That's an interesting tidbit. I didn't think about that. I just kind of assumed
Andrew was trying to think way too hard to find something in the show.
Are you right? You would automatically assume that there, I mean, it would make sense if there is male characters, there would be some kind of interaction between females and males. That's an interesting tidbit. I didn't even think about that. I automatically assumed they were, just other teachers and, or this is one in particular teacher that just had that blurry aspect and that one teacher was moving over there to talk to the principal at that particular scene. I didn't think about the male aspect. So yeah, that's an interesting tidbit that I did not catch. Thank you for catching that. Now I will think about that. That makes sense.
The broader story that I'm getting from this, it seems like my assumption here is that these are witches, right? Magic users. Mm-hmm. And in the other world, in the overworld, they're hunted down. I mean, mm-hmm. you're seen as a threat, so these guys will go out and find those girls and kill them. So this is like some sort of, you know, pocket dimension that they're hiding these girls in to train them up and then eventually, hopefully, be able to fight back. But I don't know that it's necessarily they're trained. I think it almost feels as if they're just trying to give them a happy life in this bubble. And they have to worry about the wards and keeping the bugs out, which the bugs, are, I'm assuming, are probably some kind of... probing device to find where they're at. So they have to get rid of the bugs before it discovers them. But my question mark is do they stay there forever? Because I don't think that they're training them in a way that they're going to be able to face the massacre outside.
Right.
So it almost feels like they're just trying to keep them safe in there and make them happy and train magic in case something breaks it and they can fight back. But they're not training them in a way that they'll be able to deal with that. So it does make me think that maybe eventually it will get dark, but I know it's not going to get murderous because, again, this is based off a mobile game and you don't kill waifus in mobile games. Otherwise, your gacha character dies. So my thought process is more in the idea that it's just preparing them, but not necessarily expecting that they'll have to actually fight back. But who knows? Maybe it's just an excuse to swing Tama on a rope for hours on end. Do you like my little video?
Yeah. Comes in and takes over my computer to put a Tama dangling.
Swinging over and over again. This is cute. Uncle from Another World is our next one. Isekai Oji-san. This one's streaming on Netflix, unfortunately. Studio is Atelier Pont Dark. This one is sources of manga. Genres are comedy and fantasy. Kenta Ihara is doing serious composition. They've done work for Tsukimichi Moonlit Fantasy, Life is Tough for Mobs, and Miroko-chan. So solid writer there. But yeah, this one follows Takafumi. And he is just, he's going to visit his uncle, has discovered that he is finally waking up from being in a coma for, was it 17 years? Apparently his uncle got in some sort of accident into a coma, just about the time that Sega Saturn was out, because that'll come into play later. About the time that Sega Saturn was out for a long time. And at some point, again, his uncle wakes up and his uncle claims that this entire time he's been in another world, this fantasy world where he was this guy with had magic and everything. And of course, Takafumi's like, you know, that whatever, that's fine. Look, family got broke up because you've been in a coma. Also, here's these forms I need to fill out so you can get support because I can't support you. And then, yeah, his uncle finally is able to cast a spell using Japanese and reveals that, yes, he knows magic and he was in another world. So Takafumi's like, all right, cool. Come to my place. Quickly pulls his uncle and then wants to open up a YouTube channel, make money on YouTube by making videos of his uncle using magic. Over time, kind of, again, his uncle, who was a big gamer, loved Sega, has to discover that the Sega technically failed the console wars, get up to date on everything that happened with Sega and everything, and at the same time, showing the shenanigans that unfolded in the previous world and how utterly idiotic he is. And how he handled things in the other world. But yeah, Tsundere Elf, the cold ice queen that's a shut-in, and all that shenanigans. Your thoughts?
I hate Oji-san.
He's so great.
It's one of those things that I love the fact that I hate him. He's absolutely the perfect dense character. I have never had a dense character that I've actually truly enjoyed. And he actually is pulling it off, like, fantastically.
I think it's because he's genuine about it. Like, yeah. He's an idiot, but he's, like, he's so genuine about his idiocy.
It's one of those things that when you get dense characters, you have the wishy-washy ones that, like Andrew had mentioned earlier with Vermil in Gold. In Gold, where it's those things scare me. Girls, scary. Whereas other ones, the dense ones are just they're just completely oblivious. And this one is actually pulling off. He's effectively the oblivious type, but it's like Andrew was saying, he's just kind of genuinely just not getting it. Like when Elf is coming to him, she's being mean to him. I mean,
they're nasty to each other. To be honest, they're nasty to each other.
Yeah, she's genuinely mean, and we know it as a tsundere that she actually really likes him when it comes down to it. But when it comes off in his eyes is, and you can see that when he plays these videos where she's actually saying really really crappy
ogre
faced
person. I would hang out with you, ogre faced.
And that's the stuff that it works so fantastically. And at the same time, I'm sitting here messaging Andrew on his live stream because for whatever reason, I'm always watching this while he's on his live stream. I'm like, I really hate Oji-san. I just hate him. When we seen the Ice Queen, it was the same thing. It's like, he's an idiot. I hate him.
Well, see, I mean, that was a legitimate moment. I mean, yes, technically him basically talking her into being a shut-in. The concept of it was made sense because, like, he doesn't really play JRPGs much because he'd quit playing the game. The next day he'd come back and he'd forget what quest he was on. Like, it makes sense. He came there. They said, we need to, you know, we need to warm her heart so that it melts the ice so you get the sword to kill the dragon. And then he forgets, and he immediately just goes straight to the dragon and kills the dragon. Because he remembers the part that the dragon needs to die. So he's like, okay, I just have to kill the dragon, right? He forgets about the Ice Queen. So when he comes back, and they're like, oh, you killed the dragon? They look back towards the Ice Queen lady, and she's just kind of there fidgeting in the middle of this area that her heart's still cold. He completely forgot. It's dorky in that regard.
But yeah, secret on the down low, so nobody knows what I really feel about this. Love it. For everybody else, I hate this show. I hate OG Sun. I'm never gonna watch it ever again.
Yeah, this show is amazing, and I think when we were talking about this in the preview, we were kind of uncertain. It was like one of those things of like, this hasn't had the potential of being really good or really terrible, which is everything, honestly. But it has a cool concept, the idea of the Returner. How often do you get an anime where either the Let's be real. Rare as hell to see an isekai where the person finally goes back home. It's forgotten.
I can only think of
eventually.
Like three?
Yes, technically, I would assume that most isekai source materials eventually get to that point, but anime we don't. The anime we don't get that far ever.
No, there's about two or three of them.
Okay, with this one, it's like it's the Returner is the concept, and thus it's kind of reverse. Fish out of water. He's obviously has a little bit to get caught up on. He still wants his own flip phone. Insert that joke. Getting to know about current technologies. It doesn't play too much in that stuff. It doesn't sit there and have to have Ojitan have to figure out everything new technology. He's kind of stuck in that old day. So he does want a Sega Saturn. He does buy an old magazine that talks about Sega Saturn, where it went. He does have to be explained that they lost the console war, which he quickly erases because he doesn't want to remember. He learns from Takafumi that they lost the console war, but he just quickly erases it from his memory so that he doesn't have that sorrow anymore. There is that aspect in there. It's got a bit of nostalgia for gamers. If you ever had old systems, I would say probably a good, I don't know, probably 30% of the show, maybe 25% of the show is console war humor, which is nostalgia for me. I love it a lot. I loved Guardian Heroes. It's my favorite Sega Saturn game by far. So the moment that he goes outside and goes basically Super Saiyan from a lightning strike, screaming in the thunderstorm about it being placed 194 or something like that in this catalog, I'm like, this guy knows me. Guardian Heroes was amazing. That stuff is great. The other part of it is, again, technically the interactions between Takafumi's reaction to Oji-san's stories of his previous life. He's able to bring it all up on his, like, magical monitor so that everybody can watch what happened in his previous world. A lot of those reactions of Takafumi. And then a portion of it is kind of these other things like the YouTube channel, what's working for them and what's not working for them. The introduction of Fujimiya, who's obviously in love with Takafumi, but that relationship doesn't seem like it's happening based on the memories of their childhood experiences.
Totally not making me dislike Takafumi.
It's just, what did Takafumi do there? She beat the crap out of him. What did Takafumi do? He did nothing in that flashback. He just got beat the crap out of. But anyways, yeah, it's a lot of fun. I really do enjoy it. I will say the last episode, as much as I really love the punchline in the end, I was really mad because it's a bad tease. That last episode, that was a bad tease. I think everybody was super mad about that tease, but...
With what? I don't remember anything.
You had erased it from your mind. He's got...
I have his ability.
Yeah, he basically just enchanted that spell and it worked, actually. It's like, okay, I don't remember what... I'll be looking forward to the priest. I think they the priest, but I'll be interested to see what the priest does.
That's how I forgot about Bondred. So
there you go. Forgot about Bondred. Who's Bondred?
I don't know.
You obviously know who Bondred is. But no, it's a lot of fun. I would say that like the first episode was okay. Honestly, it was okay. And then like it's been getting better and better ever since then. So this is like one of those rare cases where a lot of comedies, honestly, you get that first episode, it's got that great punchline that they probably thought about for like 10 years. And then beyond that, it's like they're just trying to keep keep selling the manga. This one really feels like they had a plan. They executed the first episode, introduced the characters, and now they're getting into the stuff. Every episode seems to be doing much better than the previous one. and I like that trend of a comedy to keep hitting, keep getting better. Yes, I will admit that I have a thing with Oji-san where, like I said earlier, I think he's genuine in the idea that he's just kind of a little bit dense on things. Obviously, he's gone through hell because his life in the other world, it's kind of like Tsukimichi Moonlit Fantasy, which is odd that the series composition writer did that one too. In the idea that when he went there to this fantasy world in his coma, everybody, he was ugly as compared to everybody in that world. Everybody in that world, similar to Tsukimichi, are good looking. And so he was seen as an ogre. He was obviously not human. And so everybody treats him terribly. But again, Elf Girl's like, you know, you're an ogre, but I'll be the only one to hang out with you. Like a genuine like there. Again, technically, this Ice Queen realizes how cool he is because he took down the dragon without the sword. Wants to be strong and outgoing like him, but then he, yeah, screws that up. He's genuine in how he does that. Or he takes out this force field that's protecting this entire village because he wants to see if he could do it. And then the moment that the elf like joins him and says, all right, let's take down all these quote-unquote titans. Obviously, they have a titan joke.
No, they were cyclopses, obviously, Andrew.
She like charges up this big, oh, powerful dash. All these cool magical circles. Gets her huge sword ready. Poor charges out there and then bam, right into this wall. It was just like, again, they're so terrible to each other, so it makes it just all that much more funny. Like, these two are perfect.
Funny, that poor baby girl.
That was hilarious because they're so perfect for each other because they're so nasty to each other. So it's like this relationship built around just being kind of that to each other. Just that to each other. And again, it's never directed.
Well, he did technically propose to her.
It's never that he directly does terrible things to her. It's just that it's always a circumstance of the situation, I guess, is the way to put it.
And then sold her engagement ring. I mean, because you would be mad at her, too.
He wanted to pay her back. The whole point of him giving the ring to her was that it was a collateral.
It was her engagement ring.
Never said that he wasn't getting engaged with her.
Obviously why you would give she a girl a ring and put it on her ring
Takafumi.
Finger.
Okay, Takafumi. Takafumi's like right here. Anyways, it's a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying it. This is actually turning out to be one of my favorites of the season right now. And I wasn't a huge fan of the style early on, and it's not like hyperly animated, but they're doing well with it.
Honestly. I do like I like the artwork.
I love the expressions and stuff. Like when he was trying to figure out if Oji-san wanted this Saturn. It's like, don't you got? And then suddenly that stupid grin pops on his face, and I'm like, yeah, he loves it. The grins are great. I'm just like the style itself overall. I wasn't a huge fan of, but I think it's grown on me. Definitely. I love the style of like the elf and stuff. They're just gorgeous.
Yeah. And in a way that's what I'm kind of talking about. I like the character artwork. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I don't think it's hyper animated at all. I'm not arguing in any way.
Oh, they're gonna
I just think the character artwork in general is very good.
Yeah. I like the artwork. I think it's just more of the settings visuals likewise. Like, cause like sometimes it's just a plain room. A lot of the perspective shots aren't that great. But the designs themselves are fine. I do enjoy them. Before I forget, cause I keep forgetting even in my videos, love that attention to detail. Did you ever notice the sound effects for like him using the what he's turned into a touchscreen magical screen? I love that he's like able to change like perspectives, pinch and zoom his memories, and then he's got like these drop downs for changing like languages and stuff. But yeah, the sound effects for the actual screen itself.
It the Sega like Saturn system different. Music. I didn't hear that, but I
like you hear that whoa, whoa, like it has the Sega Saturn console sound effects because it's basically designed by him by magic, so mm-hmm. It's really funny. Yeah, the VTuber moment. I like one of the comments was like, "It's like, oh, she's so cute, she's so cute, she's so cute." And then like one of them's like, "You don't need the console there." I'm like, "You know, somebody knows where the console's sitting."
I noticed it too. Well, I thought that it seemed like it was on purpose. But yeah, very much on purpose. The comment was okay. Yeah, you're acknowledging the joke. Gotcha.
Yep, you got it. You got it. Anyways, a lot of fun. Really enjoying it. Uncle from Another World. Engage Kiss. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll for 13 episodes. The studio is A1 Pictures. The source is original. The genres are action, comedy, romance, supernatural. The writer is Fumiaki Maruto, who did Sakano, How to Raise a Born Girlfriend, White Album, and Classroom Crisis. And the character designer is Tsunako, who did Day Day Live, Ange Verge, and Hyperdimension Neptunia. This one opens up this man-made island that they have erected. apparently they have discovered a energy source underneath this island, and this energy source is really, really powerful, very precious, but at the same time, in discovering this, they'd also discovered the existence of demons. And so while the government itself is trying to keep that a secret, they don't want the public to know that there's an existence of actual demons. They've kind of created multiple organizations to handle it. They have this organization that their whole purpose is to find capable mercenaries to go out and tackle these issues. These often they'll have like bidding wars to these different companies, different organizations that know how to fight against these demons, and they'll bid on who's going to take care of the situation, while at the same time this other part of this organization will cover up what happened. We have several shows this day, this season, about stuff happening and then an organization that it covers it up. But anyways, we follow one guy who has his own company, which his name is Shu, and he actually has this girl with him, Kisara, who's madly in love with him, that is a demon. And you kind of find out through this kind of backstory, mentions that Shu one day showed up into the city with Kisara at his side. He wanted to become one of these organizations to bid on taking down these demons. They tried to take him down because he had a demon with him, but because they were so powerful, because Kisara is literally an A-rank demon, they decided to, okay, well, we'll let you join the organization and do your thing. But yeah, so it's kind of just him, you know, bidding on these different demons that show up. Somebody will get possessed by a demon. They'll have a bid war. Whoever gets chosen goes down there, takes down the demon, and that's kind of how it's been playing out so far. Getting a little more into Shu and his backstory, I would say that the biggest hook so far was in episode 3, where we finally got into why Shu's kind of a jerk. Because we do have this other girl, Ayano, who is obviously madly in love with Shu, is constantly helping him with financial issues. They used to work together at some point, but we also discovered that, yeah, Shu and Ayano used to actually live together. They were actually in love. And for some reason, Shu's now kind of a jerk to her. Well, we kind of find out every time that he fights with Kisara. Each demon, when they make a pact with somebody, they have to give something up. Sometimes it's somebody giving up their life. They give up their talents, give up their limbs. He's technically giving up his memories to Kisara in order to power her. And so he's forgetting about everything that he experienced with Ayano, this girl that's, you know, in love with him. So that was kind of the hook at the end of there. And we got a little bit into that into episode 4 as well, this idea that Kisara has all these memories within her about Shu's love for Ayano that, you know, Ayano never knew that he lost. So your thoughts on Engage Kiss?
I'm generally in the camp of I'm fine with this show. I think it's doing okay. I like a lot of the world building that they're doing here. Not so much big on the characters. I think that they're fine. I kind of wish that it could get...
Kisara? What the heck? She's perfect yandere demon girl.
Well, I technically like both of the girls, but that's... Yes.
Just Ayano and Kisara.
Yeah, me...
That's a given.
Me liking girls has nothing to do with whether or not...
Did you come to find out?
Did you not watch episode four?
Episode four, Shu is a girl. You didn't catch that part?
No, I didn't. this is one of those things. I'm at this point on this show where it's like, I want to just get to the meat. Give me something to work with. Something that will make me really just go, okay, this is the reason this show needs to exist. I'm not saying that this show doesn't need to exist. I mean, I want something that I can go, okay, drag me along for the rest of the show. And I haven't gotten to that point. Outside of, yeah, it's interesting to see Shu and Kisara and how that's affecting Ayano. But outside of that, we've got one character who technically got away that might bring an interesting aspect to the show as a whole. And then we're being introduced to the background kind of thing that's making things work, but it hasn't really gotten into anything that I can go, yes, now it's worth my time to keep continuing on. And it is kind of frustrating. I just kind of want something to make me want to go through for the rest of the show. But as it stands right now, it's a fine show.
Yeah, I will say, like, this is the other A1 Pictures original that happens every Saturday. When the first episode of Engage, Kiss, and Licorice and Coil came out on Saturday, that first week, it was like, holy crap, dude, double whammy. A1 Pictures is going all out this season. I will admit that, like, beyond episode one, which I think was a great introduction, it showed us the chemistry between Kisara and Shu, which, again, she's technically very Yandere-esque, very overly doty, wants to sleep with him constantly. Their whole deal with being able to transfer power from Shu to Kisara is them just making out, kissing like crazy. Obviously, this is a conflict to Ayano, again, who actually loves Shu. Had a really great start. Great animation, great music. Everything was just all cylinders. My problem that I found with episode two was a huge downer, is that I feel like this writer loves to tell, not show. Everything story-wise seems to be shown by somebody talking. So within, you know, that third episode, despite the fact that I liked that hook, which is the idea that Shu is giving up all of his love and memories of Ayano to Kisara to get revenge against the demons because they killed his family, and to protect Ayano, technically, he's giving up his memories of Ayano to protect Ayano. It was all told. These two guys just standing on the sideline while things are happening, and this guy's literally going, yeah, so Shu did this. It didn't show me anything, which is really frustrating. Like, why couldn't you show me a vision of Shu walking in with Kisara into the town? Why couldn't you show me all this stuff that unfolded? Stop telling me what happens. This writer is super bad about telling and not showing. And that went into episode four. As we get into the conflict of Ayano and Kisara and the memories lost, it's just literally Kisara sitting there at a table, at a kind of sidecar thing with Ayano and telling her everything that's happened. And it's like, stop telling me what happens and show me what happens. That's this show's biggest problem, is just people talking about what's happened rather than show me what happened. Why couldn't we have episode four cut to the moment Shu and Kisara met each other, came into the town, fought against the organization, and every time he fights with Kisara, he's giving up these memories. Show what memories he's giving up of Ayano. Show me the effects rather than tell me what the effects is. It does get into a issue, which is interesting to me. My thing that I had from the third episode was, how is this going to, what are they going to do with this? I'm really curious what they're going to do with this. This idea of Kisara, technically, does she love Shu because she's getting memories of his love for Ayano, which should be technically that she falls in love with Ayano because she's getting memories of loving Ayano. But does she love Shu because of that memories of their relationship? Does Kisara love Shu because of something prior to that? Him protecting her? What came from before this that was affecting her? The thing they presented with episode four is more getting into the idea of Ayano is mad at Kisara because, in a sense, because Shu's giving up these memories to Kisara. She believes that Kisara is going to use him until he becomes a vegetable of nothingness. He's going to lose all of his memories to the point where he's nothing. He has no personality. He has no memories. From Kisara's perspective, which I'm hoping they'll eventually get into more on, is I don't care as long as I'm with him. I will turn him into a vegetable as long as I can keep being with him. There's obviously probably going to be more in there than that. She's obviously helping him get his revenge, but again, it's fine. It's got a good hook. I hope they do something interesting with that hook, which again is the Shu losing himself, Kisara eating him alive, basically, and Ayano being conflicted with the fact that she wants to stop Shu, but that's what Shu wants. But please, I know the writer ain't listening to this, but my shouting to the clouds is, please stop telling me what happens and show me what happens. Because in the end, if this keeps up, this is going to be one of those shows where I'm like, it's a cool concept, but they just tell you everything that happens. They don't show you a damn thing, which is really frustrating, honestly. It breaks so much potential there that they could possibly get into. But, yeah, let's engage, Kiss. Just watch Licorice and Coil.
No, right?
But if you can watch both of them, it's fine. So, there you go. And our last one that we're going to get into today is Uta Waramono, Mask of Truth, which, warning here, this is legit the third season of Uta Waramono. We had the first season was like in 2006. The second season was like 2015. And now we're finally getting a third season, which is this one. So this, of course, is going to be running for 28 episodes. It's going to stream on Crunchyroll. Studio is White Fox, as always. Sources of visual novel, and the genres are action, drama, and fantasy. Where do I even start? It's basically this world that's full of these kind of animal people, and they're with kind of most of the Utuwaramono. You have this one person that wakes up, and they are obviously human in a world of these weird animal creature people, and they kind of exist there. And what kind of always gets unfolds is this kind of conflict between nations. It's equally what happens with this one is this inner conflict with this really great nation. Thankfully, what we kind of had with False Faces, which was the second season, we started getting into kind of a lot of the characters from the first season, a lot of the kind of aftermath of that first season, kind of a carryover. The big deal that was happening with season two, or Mask of False Faces, was this idea that you have this Haku, who's this guy that shows up out of nowhere. He gets taken in by Kuon. Eventually, they end up into the big city of Yamato. And in this country of Yamato, you do have this emperor, you have this princess, and you have these, what was it, eight generals?
Seven or eight, yeah.
Yeah, these powerful generals that protect the nation. And at some point, you have the emperor passing away, which, slight spoiler, emperor passes away, and they start having an inner conflict about where the nation is going to go forward, and essentially having one of these generals step forward and say that they are going to take over control, and then having this conflict between the generals themselves, which leads to this season, where you have the escape of the princess, fleeing the nation, and eventually that desire to return to take back over Yamato. At the same time, on the other end, we're seeing Kuon returning to her home, learning about essentially what her, what's expected of her as what her bloodline is and what she's going to be doing going forward with this whole conflict with Yamato, as they realize Yamato keeps fighting with us and now they're kind of in a bad situation, so we might want to go over there and take down Yamato. So you kind of have pre-established friendships with Haku and everybody else that's involved with this conflict with Yamato. And then you have Kuon, who is this friend of theirs that spent a lot of time with them, now being kind of forced to have to be involved with taking them down. So, well, it's probably not going to happen. They're going to work together. You know they're going to work together. Mm-hmm. Anyways, what are your thoughts on this so far?
First couple of episodes were really rough for me. I maybe somebody else, it worked out a lot better for them. But as it stood for me, I had a really hard time trying to figure out what the heck was going on.
Because it's been like seven and technically like 15 years.
I fully acknowledge that possibility. I do kind of want to go back and just do an entire refresh of the entire show. I really do. And that idea is kind of really hankering. If it's not for the fact that I'm trying to keep up with everything and catch up on a couple of other shows, and now I've got, and plus I've got Summertime Rendering that I really got to catch up on. It's one of those things if I want to, I really, really do. And I probably will in the second core of this or something like that, because it feels like I know what the heck's going on. But it's like the small, I don't remember this. I think I remember this. This is kind of, I think I got this. And I mean, even Andrew had popped up and asked a question, and I was like, no, I think it's this particular character in the first season. And it's like, I don't know. The only thing I can figure to fix the entire problem is to just go in through the entire show. I was planning on just playing the games, but the games look really,
that would
really,
take
really
a
painful.
Long time. You're talking about having time. You're going to watch the
games.
Yeah,
the games look really, really painful as well. So it's like, I don't know. I really want to just get an entire refresh of this story. Because I do really enjoy this. I enjoyed the second season. I enjoyed the first season. I'm enjoying this. I love these characters. I really do truly love them. So yeah, that's where it is right now. I think it was a really, really brutal start. Finally starting to get some semblance of, okay, I see where we're, it seems like I see where we're going, and I can't wait to see where they're going in the future. So that is.
I would say I think the first season of Utuwaramono was great. Loved it to death. really fantastic. I will say that the second season really took a long time to get into my interest. Technically, with the first half of the second, because what happens is you essentially have this like timeline of this guy named Hakuro in the first season. That's Hakuro's story. He is this guy that's obviously human. He's walking amongst all these beast people, eventually gets involved with this big conflict with this small nation trying to help them protect themselves. It turns into a big, huge kingdom versus kingdom battle that he's all involved in, and he's leading people. And eventually gets into this big, huge twist at the end. With a second season, it's like all those characters disappear. We're now following Haku, who is this guy that's similar in the situation where he's a human waking up in this world, don't know where he came from, no memory of himself, just like Hakuro, but new cast of characters. Technically, Kuon being sort of connected with that previous. That previous nation is still existing, so we know there's a connection there. The story is obviously just after it, but we have new characters. Haku goes off, goes to this new kingdom of Yamato, meets all these people, gets this big, huge, massive harem. The first half of that second season was rough for me. Loved meeting the characters. Looks great still. Cute moments. A lot of ecchi. Just seemed like tons of bath scenes. Like that full first half of that story was like, what are we even doing here? What is in the point of the story? Get to the meat. Like, I'm looking for Hakuro. I'm waiting for that moment. He's leading a nation in the big battle. That was the stuff that I loved about the original series. Wasn't getting any of that. It was just literally Haku getting a harem. I wasn't liking it. It didn't feel like Utoramono. It wasn't until like that later part of the second season where I'm like, or massive false faces, where I'm like, oh, this is it. This is the stuff. Suddenly we're getting into some crazy stuff here. We're starting getting the generals fighting over this nation. We get the backstory of Haku, the emperors, all that kind of stuff. That was the nugget. Like at the moment that you have the emperor go, okay, let me tell you what's going on. That's where I'm like, okay, cool. This is the stuff that I'm going to eat up. And I loved every minute of it all the way to the end of it. And then again, we jump forward 8 years again, like in our world, and we're finally getting this final season. And yes, when I first started watching this season, I'm like, I don't remember anything. Like I remember people. I don't remember anything that was going on. I don't remember what they revealed. So yeah, I had to spend like an entire night just refreshing on everything that happened in season one, everything that happened in season two. And now I'm right back into this one and I am hooked. Like the moment the first episode starts up, I'm hooked. The only thing that I will say that I would be critical about with this season is I don't think they handled Haku right. With the original season, with season one, Hakuro was a great character because he starts from small and he goes to grand. This is a guy that went through so many battles trying to protect people. And so he seems like he makes sense to character. Whereas Haku just seems like he's thrown right into, all right, time to lead battles. Haku's always been a spaz. Like, he is, like, yes, he's there when he needs to be there. He's still a good person, but he's not a general. And so it just seems like he's thrown into this situation way too quickly. Like, the character change is way too much. Now, granted, there is an aspect that I understand about how he's acting right now, and I love that they're actually addressing him, realizing that he might be pushing too hard. We're getting into war crimes, essentially, which I think is really fantastic, and I think it's going to help his character. I just think it transitioned a little bit too quickly. But being, if I get myself to overlook that a little bit and just kind of let it slide, what they're getting into, the characters returning, all this kind of stuff is still absolutely fantastic. I'm curious to see what they'll do with Kuon. They just kind of had another kind of similar aspect with her and her kind of accepting her status in this recent episode. And I'm interested to see what they end up doing with her, but everything is turning out like in this season, everything that I love about Utoramono is suddenly coming to a head. Like everything is starting to connect and it's starting to come to this final epic moment with the story that I'm really looking forward to. We're pulling the old cast. We're pulling the new cast. We're getting into this insane change in Haku and still kind of hoping something else left behind in this first season will come into play with this season, but we'll have to wait and see. But it's same Utoramono that I've always loved, except for that segment in the second season, and I'll always love it. I think this is probably one of the coolest fantasy franchises that I think people don't talk about enough. And honestly, to my own discredit, I've had several times where I don't think about Utoramono, despite the fact that it's technically up there as one of my favorite fantasy shows of all time. I absolutely love the characters. I love all the story beats. I love a lot of the backstory stuff that they get into on a regular basis. And I cannot wait for more of it. So I'm really happy to know this is 28 episodes. That means that there's a lot to go through. There's still plenty for him to get through. And I can't wait to see what it does going forward. So yeah, White Fox has always done a fantastic job. It looks really good. There's a couple points where there's some CGI usage, but overall, White Fox delivers. It's not to like the levels of like ReZero or anything like that, which is their other property that they do. But they always manage to make the characters on model. The characters look really fantastic. I've always loved a lot of the character designs in this series, so that's definitely a plus for me. And Atui is still one of my favorite girls, so.
Hey, throwing it out there, I absolutely love the fact that how grand this series feels. It is, like Andrew was talking about, the fact that it starts out kind of more smallish and then it slowly builds up until you start to suddenly realize, wow, is this the scope of the story? And it is. It is really a massive story when it comes down to when everything is all out on the table and you go, wow. I mean, I thought we were going to this big, but no, you're going to that big. So yeah, it's one of those that is very impressive when you really take into consideration the scale of the story.
I just want to see the moment where that scene in the OP happens. Cause like out of nowhere, like this girl literally goes crazy punch. And I'm like, wait, I'm not expecting this girl to have some crazy superpower punch, but I really want to see when that happens because obviously, I mean, there's implied reasons why she would be as powerful as she is, but it's like one of those like scale thing where you see this little cute girl and she suddenly has this insane punch. But we'll see. We'll see. But yeah, love the characters, love the world. And again, it's been technically a long story. It's been a long story.
Yeah.
I think the unfortunate thing is it's like people wanting to get caught up at this point. It's going to be it's a worthwhile trek, honestly. The sucky thing is that I think like the first season, I think the first season's on, I don't know if the first season was available. No, I think it's on High Dive. I think the first season or the second season on High Dive. One of them's on Crunchyroll. I think this one's for sure on Crunchyroll, but I think the first season and second season are on High Dive. So it's kind of it's all over the place if you wanted to actually watch it. So that's I think the problem is I think the first season's not available. The second season for sure I think is on Sentai, and this one's on Crunchyroll. I think that's what it was. So it's kind of unfortunate if you do want to end up watching it. It's kind of all over the place. So yep. So first season's on, and they haven't moved it over yet. First season will eventually be on Crunchyroll because it's on Funimation's catalog. So like right now, this moment of recording this, Funimation for season one, High Dive for season two, Crunchyroll for season three. Again, technically the first will eventually end up on Crunchyroll. So, but yeah, it is a long story. We're looking at like 26 for the first season and False Faces was, what was
it? Looked like it was 20 something.
So 26, 25, and then 28. So it's a lot. I mean, overall, I mean, so far, if you want to get caught up right now, it's 26, 25, and then like 5. So it's investment, but it's definitely a great story. Again, like I said, besides that kind of lull in the second season, which if you like a lot of fan service, you'll be fine with it. But if you don't, it gets a little bit sidetracked, but if you do like ReZero a lot, White Fox probably is adapting this for the sole sake of Sadana and Ururu. So it's like literally their Ram and Ram, which are like these two cute ballet dancing looking girls that serve him and everything. So yeah, I love the characters. Fantastic stuff. But anyways, that's Utawarabano Mass of Truth. Cannot wait to complete that story. But it's great to know that's a full adaptation, honestly, at this point. So I have some information about Kuon that I'm hoping eventually they'll reveal, but that's why I was asking Chris about that. I'm like, I don't remember them ever getting into it, but I've heard something was missing in the first season adaptation that technically explains it. They revealed a little bit into it with this last episode, so I'm sure they're going to get into her. They're obviously purposely being vague about her mother, so I know for a fact now, based on that, that they don't want to reveal it yet for the anime only. So I'm going to keep my mouth shut on that. So looking forward to it. Definitely looking forward to it. But yeah, anyways, that's part one of our summer 2022 anime season first impressions. Hope you guys enjoyed this run through of a ton of shows. Again, next week we will have a slew more of shows like Isekai Life, Made a Hired recently as Mysterious, Parallel Pharma, which I think is doing well right now. Yakuza's Guide to Babysitting, Luminous Witches, Phantom of the Idol, Classroom of the Elite, Shadow House, Call of the Night, Rent a Girlfriend, Devil's Part-Timer, Overlord, Orient, A Couple of Cuckoos, Prima Doll, Lucifer, The Biscuit Hammer, Extreme Hearts, and Danmachi 4. So look forward to that. As always, definitely appreciate everybody that supports the channel and all the stuff that we do through Patreon, our tips link, or our, if you're on YouTube, Super Thanks button. Again, all the links are at otakuspirit.com. Definitely appreciate everybody's support, and you all take care.
We split it into two parts, and we still got a 3-hour episode out of it.
Shit on three.
Os!